to address a few other issues in the effect of the gambling bill. And as you know, we've not had an opportunity to engage directly with the opponent, the person who tabled the legislation. And there's a need, always, for the chair and person, and often the DTI who tabled legislation, but in this case it was private members' bill. There's a need for me to keep in an equal relationship with Parliament, notwithstanding some of the comments made yesterday, does work transparently. We certainly make every effort to do that. And we also like to recognise it as practices, the fact that it is a multi-party parliament. And let us just respect that. Thank you. On that note, I'd like to welcome everyone. I'm looking for agenda. Right. Agenda, sort of full page, yes. Okay. We do have apologies. So let me allow Mr. Hearns to give us the apologies.
Chairperson, I have an apology for Mr. Williams, who's still. Also, Ms. Doctor, an apology for arriving late. And also, Ms. EDG, who's in the kitchen, who's arriving late.
Okay, I believe she's just said to arrive last night from Brazil. So, okay, here we go, in front, isn't it? It must have sort of come to a meeting next morning, but we appreciate that. You don't have an apology then from the IFP or the EFF?
No official apology needed.
I would like to remind all members of the committee that while an emergency, an SMS is very welcome, you know, if you're caught in traffic and things like that, but under normal circumstances, under regular circumstances, especially when your own chief whip is asking, do give up a written apology, because that's what's recognised by the tax man. And some of you know, in your individual party, it was a lack of reconciliation between what the committee had and what you thought you had. So that's why it's important. In the end, it becomes a tax issue for all of us. Did your head work? Yeah, right. Okay. So it's that kind of thing. We don't fill in job cards, so you fill that. Thank you very much. And also, great welcome to the Banking Association, National Responsible Gambling, the Casino for Malela, Wayne Lurie attorney, and Garrett Weitzman attorney. But can we have someone on that note to just allow me to put one small thing in, a program change, and I do need to just brief the committee about the process of gambling legislation and policy. So on that note, can I have someone to propose adoption? Thank you, Honourable Mantash, seconded by Honourable Calago. Right. Immediately then, we go to the Banking Association, Kath Guardia, old friend of the committee, Managing Director of the Banking Association. You go ahead, and if you've got anyone with you, then please introduce them.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Abdul, next to me, and Vishal behind me are from a group of ethical who do a lot of our parliamentary preparatory work. I think are known to this committee. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for accommodating us on quite early on the agenda. Let me start with an apology first. The documents. You were sitting here until 11 o'clock last night, finalizing the documents. I've been traveling for a fairly short notice, and I asked if at all possible to be accommodated early, because I do have some World Economic Forum commitments. I've got an interview there at 10 o'clock. Chairperson, these are initial comments with a view that we will, at the appropriate time, engage with the bill as a committee schedule that. But these are initial comments just to put on the table what the Banking Association views are about the regulation or non-regulation of internet gambling or online gambling. We do did make detailed submissions to the committee in 2011 on this matter. And our positions in 2011 have remained consistent. Our position today is what it was in 2011. We are essentially agnostic about whether online gambling is regulated or not. That is obviously a decision for governments to make. We do appreciate the problems of unregulated gambling. But we would urge that if any consideration is given to regulating online gambling, that in such consideration, authorities also ensure that they have the capacity and the willingness to monitor and to enforce such regulations. Because in 2011, we had a situation where there were views coming from government that the banking sector should regulate, they should enforce this. And we took the view at that time that it's impossible for us to do so, and that position remains. And so, if it is regulated, then government has to have the capacity to enforce the regulation. Banks can't monitor and enforce this regulation for a number of reasons. And just chairperson is to say, I had a discussion this morning with the CEO on the phone with the Payments Association of South Africa, just to confirm that what I'm saying about the inability of the payment system to regulate this is correct, and he did confirm that. Firstly, our national payment system is a world-class one, and it is globally integrated and globally regulated. Okay, so we have globally integrated banks. Our payment system is globally integrated. It deals with large volumes of transactions, and as a result of that, it has reached and ensured that it has a high degree of standardization of its systems to deal with those high volumes of transactions. The messaging it receives from those transactions does not enable it to identify what the reasons for transactions are. Okay, so whether a transaction is going through for online gambling or a transaction is going through for a online purchase of goods, the payment system has no way of actually differentiating. Online gambling that originates in countries where it is illegal, it processes real time, and the system can't identify the transaction as being for gambling. Also, online gambling is often consolidated into the total gambling operations, and thus, in inverted commas, hidden in those broader business operations, and we can't identify that. Service providers who provide the platform for online gambling also often use fronts that are pretty legitimate, and there's no way we can pick that up. So, for those reasons, it's virtually impossible for banks through the payment system and to see the payment issue to actually track, monitor, stop online gambling. We just aren't able to do that. And there's no way that we can change systems to the whole area of online gambling and use of the internet is such that it doesn't enable us to do it. We will, however, act to stop online gambling transactions, these authorities track, monitor, and identify it. So the Reserve Bank's Act often points out to us and to the payment system some major players that they believe have suspicious transactions. And on the basis of that, we can then identify those particular transactions because the originator of those transactions have been identified through regulation on every Reserve Bank or ESCOM. And we can then block or take whatever remedial action is necessary to do that. But then on the basis that a regulatory authority has tracked this and has identified the source of the transaction, we can then hone in on that particular transaction and take the remedial action that is necessary. So, for those reasons, we would be very, very uncomfortable if deliberations lead to a situation where regulation is passed, but the banking sector, or the payment sector system in particular, is asked to actually enforce that regulation. We this country, not said we don't want to do it, we can't do it. But if the regulation is passed and the necessary regulatory authorities through the regulatory system identify sufficient behavior or identify specific acts of transgression of that regulation and inform the payments system administrator of other, then we can do something about the specific transactions. But we certainly can't proactively begin to identify. In conclusion, those are our English comments, and that's the position that we have as the Banking Association of South African Economists. We would certainly welcome more detailed and more substantive interaction on this and engagement on this. If the department or anybody involved in this process is able to put on the table practical ways in which the payment system can monitor and track us, we're more than willing to hear that. We don't think it's possible, but we're more than just willing to hear that. I think in conclusion, we do believe that deliberation need to take into account that the banking sector in South Africa is the most stable banking sector in the world, according to the Global Competitive Report. Now, it has that recognition, because our regulators, certainly the prime regulator, which is the Reserve Bank, have been very proactive in regulating this industry, and we have been very stable. There haven't been any major transactions through the system that have been picked up by any regulatory authorities that are systemic in any way or that are problematic in any way, from a money laundering point of view, from gambling point of view, or any other point of view. And so we have a stable sector that's very well regulated, and we should consider that a national asset. At the end of the day, the business of banks is to raise deposits, to hold these in trust, and leverage these to extend credit responsibly, so that those deposits are protected. So it's got to be responsible credit on the part of the credit extender and on the part of the borrower. And banks are heavily regulated for this business. They're particularly heavily regulated because they hold deposited money in trust. And the bank cannot say that, tell a depositor that we lent the money and we didn't get it back, and so we can't actually make the money available if you want it. And that's why the bank has to lend responsibly as well, in a way that it gets money back. Banks are already regulated by various regulatory authorities like the NCR, the FNB, and others. And we believe that they are appropriately regulated. And within the context of those regulations, we will do whatever we can to assist in acting against illegal activity, be it gambling or anything else. But I think we must stress that we can only come in at the point where the activity has taken place, has been identified, and we then need to block that activity going forward. And so we block that particular individual's transactional activity or that particular company's transactional activity once it has been identified by regulatory authorities. So, Chairperson, those are just very few brief comments from us to position where we are on this issue. We would, at the appropriate time, like to give more detailed comments on the bill itself. I haven't had a chance to look at it all yet, and we will do that. So let me stop it, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kavadi. I'm sorry you haven't had a chance to look at the bill. It did go up, I believe, Honorable Hill Lewis indicated to us, and I know others have commented from seeing the bill itself. You must make sure you do get a copy this morning, then. Oh, I see. Right. Okay. Now, thank you very much. We do welcome the DVD, although she will be required to attend up in the NLB in the select committee. Is that correct, sir? Thank you. But she has left here a full team, I understand. We've got the chief director here, with Annette Kennedy, chief director, legislative drafting, and that is Dr. Nonyani Mokabani, and Ms. Conwer, Chairman NetNGB, Mr. Masha Maite, Director Gambling Policy and Law, Mr. Mwani, Assistant Director Gambling Law and Policy, and Ms. Yonke, Research Manager for the NGB. So there's a full team here, and of course we've also got a little team, Advocate Pam Murbert is here from our parliamentary legal office just to ensure that we do things in the procedural manner and within the Constitution. Thank you very much. We have got your medical apology for being late. Thank you. Members, now we do want to release Mr. Cavalio, asked to be released quite early, and I did start later. I would like to ask members to immediately raise the comments and queries with him now, please. Are there any questions, queries? In fact, I couldn't quite see on the audio list. Does it have anything? No. I just have a couple. You say, Mr. Cavalio, you know that obviously you're always monitoring this kind of thing, but that you can only do so when it has already been identified. When I see you, I mean the bank. Now, I'd like some clarification there, because I ask myself, if a bank is made aware of by an organ state that these things are illegal, and they give you the names, for example, and they do X, and when that goes in, he's watched out for that, don't be sending the money there. Then is the computer system not programmed sufficiently to identify that transaction? As I decide to pay and spend my South African money on an illegal entity. Thank you.
And Chair, I said that we're not able to proactively monitor. So if you spend your money on what is an illegal entity, that money goes through the system. If DTI or somebody else then comes to us and says, we have picked up that John Fox transacted with ABC Gambling in an illegal entity, we want you to block that transaction and we want you to ensure that all of the transactions with that entity are blocked. That we can do. Okay. That's a payment system can do because it's a specific transaction, it's a specific identified recipient of money. They can then ensure they can then put in the mechanism into the system to block all transactions with that recipient, irrespective of where those transactions come. It won't go through our payment system. Okay. So that we can do. And that's why SouthExcom does. SouthExcom investigates these things. And if they identify suspicious activity with any entity, they would inform the payment system which works, which is regulated under the net of payments system left in power. And they will then instruct the payments system administrator to actually block all transactions in future. But the payments system administrator is unable to say, okay, the money went from John Fox to somewhere else, or there has been a transaction. They are unable to identify whether that transaction has broken the law or not. And so that's our problem. But post the act, once it is pointed out and the transaction identified, the individual or the company is identified, we can certainly act to ensure that it doesn't happen.
I'm just going to pursue this a minute. So if we give you a list, we say, this list is very legal. We don't want any funds going through your clients to this entity. I've made the transaction yet, but you know. So, I would have thought the computer system was capable of this.
Yeah, Madam Chair, if you were to extract that list, the UN's list of, we get a list of people or organizations, and transactions will not happen with those organizations. Okay, but the payment system, if you ask the payments administrator to say, okay, money went from here to there, is that an illegal transaction, they're not going to be able to tell you. But even, if you give us a list today to say the following 10 companies or groups we believe are conducting illegal gambling activity, we do not want transaction with Abdul. We can do. Okay, but we can do that on the basis of a regulatory authority coming to us and telling us to. And they've identified those people.
No, thank you very much, because already you're able to identify the quantity. If funds are above a certain number, the amount, then it immediately flags. And certainly one's aware of that kind of system already operating, purely the amount. But I want to thank you, Mr. Kabadia. Yes, Honorable Hill Lewis?
I don't want to hold on Mr. Kabadia, because my mission is actually for the DCI in response to that. That presentation. But I think Mr. Gavadia's, as you've just interrogated, has made the point that the enforcement capacity of the banks relies on the investigative capacity of the state entities, various state entities, including the DCI, but perhaps the NLB, the NGB, to identify these so-called illegal operations. Now, I think that's an interesting point. That we need to reflect on and that the DTI should respond to, because the argument up until now has been that it's, or as I've understood it, is that it is possible to, on a very large scale, block these activities from happening at source. But if it is not possible to proactively block the transactions, and it is only possible to do it reactively on the basis of an investigation conducted by the enforcement body, then that is much slower and much smaller scale. And I think that presents a significant problem, the one that I've been alluding to the last few days, in terms of enforcement. The second question, perhaps this is one that Mr. Kumar could quickly just answer before he leaves. If a South African citizen transfers funds to an offshore bank account through a South African bank, that transfer obviously goes through your system, and it also goes through the SARB. But what happens to the money when it reaches the foreign bank accounts? It does not go through your system, I presume, and you would have no knowledge of that. I just wanted to make sure that I understand that correctly.
Yeah, I mean, the money would go through the transfer intent would be made once it ran into the foreign bank account. It's out of the jurisdiction of our lending system. If somebody comes and withdraws the money, use it for illegal purposes, nothing we can do about that. But as the chairperson said, we do have certain thresholds. So if suddenly a significant amount of money is paying out, then we would flag that. Okay? Or SARB would flag that and tell us to follow that up. The issue you raise is that we can't proactively block if we are told, if the regulator authorities have done whatever they need to do, and they've identified certain people who they think are suspects, and they then instruct us to block transactions of those people. That's the payment system can do. But we can't proactively identify that individual or entity as an illegal entity.
Right. On that note, we are going to be able to release you, Mr. Kavadia, but obviously we would want you to make yourself available if necessary during the policy process as well. Thank you.
Sure, thank you very much, and thanks for accommodating me. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have the National Responsible Gambling Program, NRGP, and then Dr. Pretorius, Dr. A. Pretorius, a treatment director. Is Dr. Pretorius? Ah, here we are. And we would like to welcome you back, Ms. Sheldon, and we hope we don't get you packing back to hospital. So we're certainly going to be very aware that you need some space. Thank you very much. You're very welcome. It's great to see you here. Same with yourself as it is sent to the fund. Right. Thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you. Right. Are we ready, Dr. Pretorius? Thank you. You put in yourself here.
Yes,
right. Just bring a couple of members with you.
Number three. We don't want them here. Good morning, everyone, Madam Chair, and thank you for the invitation to be part of this process and to submit in our view. So I've said quite a couple of pages that I'm sure every member have received or will receive, so I'm just going to go through some of the points which I think is worth mentioning. So if we look at remote gambling, I think the issues and the particular problems that it poses to legislators and regulators is the fact that suppliers and consumers could probably be in different jurisdictions. We could make it a bit more complex. Remote gambling, or it's currently already widely available in South Africa, and from servers outside of South Africa. We know that it's fairly popular with consumers worldwide, but currently it forms a very small percentage of gambling undertaken by South Africans. We think it's probably going to grow in popularity as more user-friendly and cheaper technology becomes available. Just in terms of the numbers of National Responsible Gambling Program, we have a counting line that operates 24 hours a day. We've seen that in the previous year, 2013-14, 1.7% of the people that called our line gambled on the internet, and that has doubled to 3.4% in the last year, which is still not a substantial number, but bear in mind that gamblers are a notorious population for not seeking help. So this is the health-seeking population that we've seen this growth. We obviously have no idea how big the problem is for people who do not call us. So in our view, thinking and devising a good policy for remote gambling is about how to consider how do we minimize harm and maximize benefits from new ways of delivering the traditional gambling products that are already available to South Africans from unauthorized jurisdictions abroad. At present, we know that most South Africans, certainly the population that we deal with, are not aware, most of the population, that remote gambling is illegal. We also realize that it's a difficult issue to enforce, and we also realize and recognize that we are not unique in the world and that many other jurisdictions have similar dilemmas. So in our view, the challenge with South African legislation is how to subject this industry to appropriate regulation so to protect the South African consumers, especially the young, but also it should be desirable to regulate in such a way that some economic benefits accrue to the general public through various kinds of taxation, investment, and employment. In terms of the potential risks of remote gambling, we know that gambling becomes more risky, and therefore what I mean by that is the potential for it to become problematic. If there is continuous rapid action play, if the stakes are high, if the prizes are high and frequent, and if it's if the convenience of the gambling discourages people from planning and budgeting for their gambling, and it encourages them to gamble impulsively. Also, when people are able to just gamble as often as they like for whatever amount and they're ignorant about how gambling works. This is when gambling risk of gambling increases. From all those points of view, we believe that gambling via the internet or other technologies, especially when it's unregulated, is maximally risky from the point of view of encouraging problem gambling. Even if that is the case, we, from the Responsible Gambling Program side, do not believe that the vast majority of people would end up with problem gambling. Similar to land-based operations, most people, the majority of people, engage in this activity in a responsible and a sensible way. Currently, the numbers from prevalent studies, the number of prevalent studies that we have conducted here tells us that about 1% of adult population have disordered gambling or pathological gambling, if you want to call it that, and around 4% of people gambling gamble to a point where they do damage to themselves or they have problematic gambling. Our research in South Africa indicates that our numbers are broadly in line with international norms. So that are, those are the numbers in terms of gambling activity, and you know, it's difficult to predict whether this will change, but it hasn't changed over the years. It's our belief that the internet is the one form of gambling which makes it easier to require operators to put in place safety measures to discourage people from gambling excessively. And these could include the following. Prominent links to websites where players can perform a self-test to see whether they have a problem gambling, where they can receive education about gambling, how to gamble safely and responsibly, and they could be brought into touch with internet counseling facilities and the NRGP services that we offer. So we believe that that is possible through regulation. Operators can also simply offer players and encourage them to use the facility for setting limits to losses or their expenditure. And I know that there's very advanced software available that can detect patterns of play. And when a gambler signs on to a site, it is possible for that person to see how much they've gambled over the last month, how much they spent money-wise, and how much time they've spent. So that is an option. Also, a self-exclude option, I think, should be made available on those websites for people to prevent themselves from signing on to that website. So as you know, we're a treatment organization. We're not mandated to regulate, but we have an opinion, and we also have history so that we've seen that it's happened. We believe that regulation is most unlikely to eliminate remote gambling at offshore sites, since there are many ways around banking and ISP restrictions. In general, the consequence of prohibition is to ensure that the prohibited goods and services are often provided illegally and then by organized crime in this instance. In other jurisdictions, the UK is the only developed country that has legalized and defined regulations for remote gambling, and it's been effective in 2007. There have been other attempts, and it's been internet gambling was prohibited in Australia by the federal government. It was also prohibited in the US, making it a criminal offense. And in Italy, for a short period, internet service providers were prohibited from doing business with known internet gambling sites. Prohibition, however, is normally favored by groups on moral or religious grounds, and often those who want to protect their existing business. I've spoken about the UK. So, you know, in our view, the free market, there's an option to have prohibition or to have a free market, or to have a regulated industry. If the South African government, if Parliament rejects the proposal both for prohibition and the free market, then there are a number of other principles that should be brought into consideration. I'm not going to go through the detail there. I'm sure you'll have it in your facts. But there are a number of things that government needs to take responsibility for if these sites overseas sites continue to operate without regulation. Just a few brief comments on international research on the prevalence and potential risks of internet gambling. Firstly, few studies have been conducted and published on internet gambling. There are a couple of lessons that we can learn from the UK and the information from GamCare, their responsible gambling agency, was that in 2011, the people who seek help from GamCare who engaged in internet gambling was around 18%, and that has risen to 34% in the next year, in 2012. So that has doubled, that number has almost doubled from 2011 to 2012. There was also a finding from GamCare that 20% of the callers, again, the help-seeking population, were under 18 years of age, and that there was a steep increase in women gambling, And because the proliferation of online gaming has brought into the home an activity that was historically male dominated. A study that was recently published in the European Journal of Public Health was that greater overall involvement in gambling appears to be predictive of harm. And the results from that study, they have found that people with multiple internet gambling accounts are more likely to get into trouble through irresponsible gambling. Another study, an Australian study, also published in 2015, was that internet gamblers were significantly more likely than problem land-based gamblers to be male, younger, have low psychological distress, and experience problems with sports and rage and race wagering. The only problem, and I think you know that is something that we need to take into consideration, should this activity be legalized. So all gamblers are normally a low health-seeking population, and it seems from the study, albeit the only study and it's a relatively small one, that the uptake of health was significantly lower in compared to land-based gamblers. So internet gamblers are less likely to seek help from the results from this study. So it means, I think, for the regulators as well as our program, that we need to look at customized efforts to, you know, reach this population and to offer help. Just a few recommendations then from the National Responsible Gambling Program. Firstly, we have a neutral view on gambling. We take no view on whether or not it's a good thing that people enjoy buying the products which commercial gambling businesses sell. I said earlier that currently it's not a serious problem in the callers that we find that call our line for help. The percentage of people who engage in internet gambling is low, but it's possible that this may increase, and this, in our view, is more likely to happen if internet gambling remains prohibited, rather than it's well regulated with operators who are required to put in place the safety measures that we have mentioned before. Other recommendations around technology, we believe that it could be possible to use technology to change technology, and we therefore think that it's important that legislation includes, amongst other things, the following. A requirement that suppliers demonstrate that they have effective player identification procedures, and that is more relating to underage gamblers. Requires operators to conform to a code of practice. Links to a source of website information, more on the education side, after education or problem gambling. Easy access to self-test. And then also to have the NRGP information and how they can reach us published on their site. And make mention that of legal gambling available on the internet, TV, etc. Is legal only if it's legalized and registered in South Africa. The NRGP therefore favors legislation and regulation of remote gambling because it will make possible the imposition and enforcement of these provisions for the avoidance of problem gambling. We do recognize that current research on gambling, internet gambling or remote gambling is not conclusive, and we propose that further research on the prevalence and or impact of remote gambling is researched. Just a few other considerations that fall outside of the mandate of the NRGP is that, you know, the law should probably call for incentives. For example, the right to advertise that could be restricted to companies who are headquartered in South Africa for regulatory and taxation purposes. There might be requirements for a .za suffix to their web address. It's also necessary that equipment that they use should be certification set, and that the South African regulatory authorities should inspect these. Lastly, it is not possible to protect land-based operations from cheaper competition from the internet. However, such competition is likely to be more damaging if the competition comes from unregulated sites abroad than from well-regulated South African sites. which of course may be existing South African gambling companies who may be expected to operate successfully themselves and enjoy the advantages in respect of marketing and reputation. So that is all from me. Thank you very much. I'll take any questions or Victoria.
Right. Now, that's just a quick note from myself, and then we will take an engagement from the members. Are you a psychologist or what sort of counsellor are you?
I'm a clinical psychologist.
You're a clinical psychologist. Have you specialised in?
Many things, amongst them addiction.
Addiction.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. And you've been how long involved in this area?
5 years.
Thank you. Right. Over to members. Honourable Congi, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Albert, Honourable Kroenhoff.
Hello, thank you very much for visit. Lord, thank you very much for visit. It's essential to have you welcome the presentation from the National School for Champion Foundation. I just have a few questions. You know, most of these presentations, you find that the lowest denominator becomes a question of the freedom of choice. That we must be careful not to infringe people's freedom of choice. And sometimes I ask myself, how big or how responsible is that choice? When is government supposed to be taking a position on the limitations of the freedom of choice? I'm coming from Japan from an international youth conference. We're discussing violence and young people. And one of the issues that we're discussing was the access to internet and the freedom of choice that people had to perpetuate violence, extremism, and so forth. And how do you define that in a responsible country like South Africa? Because if you see this is a potential danger, which is more weighing more than the other? When a young girl takes a plane to join ISIS, influenced by internet and other related technologies, which is weighing more from each other? So I'm raising this point that when we discuss this matter, especially dealing with market and the freedom of choice, which one is weighing more than the other? That is, they should take a decision. Because it's the freedom of choice of that young girl to go and join ISIS. The freedom of choice. And then where do we want? So I'm raising this as part and parcel of beginning the debate. To say these are the issues that we must look at the role of the state to prevent the potential danger of a particular game or a system.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Honorable Hill Lewis.
Chairperson, let me just say, I think someone responsibly and completely legitimately spending a few minutes a day or however many times a month of their life gambling at home is not quite the same as someone joining an international terror organization where they're going to go blow up people and kill Christians and, I don't really think that we can call those the same thing. One is an entirely legitimate choice made by a responsible individual in a open economy. The other is a fundamentalist decision to join a terror group. So, in one case, the state must obviously and absolutely intervene to prevent the growth of international terror organizations. In the other example, it would not be appropriate, in my view, for the state to limit individual choice in that case. Now, that being said, I just wanted to clarify one thing with the U.S. client hearers. With the doctor, on slide number, on page number 3, your bottom slide, I just picked up on your first bullet point. You say regulation is most unlikely to, we may just have a confusion of terms. We need to speak about regulation in this committee. What we mean is the regulated legalization of most gambling. I think what you mean is prohibition. In that first word.
What
page 3, the bottom slide. Your second bullet point refers to prohibition, and I think you mean prohibition in the first bullet as well, but it should be prohibition is most unlikely to eliminate remote gambling at offshore sites.
I guess so, yes.
Great,
14.
Dr. Pretorius, and I think if you can just go through that again, I mean, it'd be useful if Dr. Pretorius could locate us.
Okay, on the third page, the second line, the first bullet, which reads, regulation is most unlikely to eliminate remote gambling.
Sorry about that, Dr. Victoria. There were a couple of things I wanted to raise. I can't just see where it is, but on one hand, you indicate yourself there that in a way gambling becomes more risky and problem gambling is stimulated, but offers opportunities for continuous rapid action on your own home. You know, you've only got to look at grandchildren to see the way their little fingers are banging away. So I'd actually get a lot of rapid action going on from teenagers, from young people, and of course those who have a problem with this. The high stakes, I don't think empty stakes is one of the things, but then you've also got a third bullet here, high and frequent prizes. Again, we know from a couple of dog stories, go ahead and give someone a prize, give something rewarding, you're never going to stop it. That's it. Oh, gosh, you know. So now I don't know what we'll do yet. Now, when it comes to a free market, and I think, Honourable Hilder, you know, the point I understood that Honourable Nkongi was making was about the access, you're not here, just the text, yeah, the access issue. Yes, there is a mistake, but it's the access, the challenge of access, which is highlighted here, Dr. Pretorius, you talk about the alternative to prohibition is a free market. Then you qualify it, not even in Las Vegas. I don't know what Las Vegas has got that prevents you. And put no amount of scripture. But the other thing then is reference to Italy. And I didn't catch what you said about Italy and other comparison studies you may have done in this direction. A concern that I have is we've got the internet. We know only too well how easy it is to access that internet. And we've heard Honourable Hill Lewis himself acknowledge or point out to the committee about some countries wanting to stop, what is this, Google or something, and then having to get modified. How? Because you don't hear and you talk about, you know, we should open it up because if we prohibit it, you have this problem, you regulate another problem. But then you say, governments should protect minors. Well, I'd like you to tell me how. How? How are we going to protect minors? Can you tell me that? Thank you. Honorable Kalako, I mean,
back to the first question, on that sentence which Honorable Lewis was raising, we argue this, we argue a lot around prohibition and isolation, but I want to go back to that, because I want to understand you clearly, because I don't agree with what you're saying. I think you mean what you're saying, that regulation most unlikely to eliminate. And I understand you as you say exactly that, not prohibition. But at the same time, in your concluding slides, seemingly to me, your argument in the whole, despite all the problems you have raised, which are created by online channels, gambling, or internet, you seem to that, to conclude that precisely because this thing is there, it's operating beyond any government control. People are just getting into the internet and gambling. So to you, you'll favor government regulation, if I understand you. You favor government regulating this gambling than just looking at it and giving up. Is that what you are proposing to us? That is rather better to regulate it, for something to know, to deal with the problem, instead of saying, okay, it's there, you just leave.
A short follow-up, Honourable Nkongi, because you've already had a bite. Thank you.
And I'm still standing with my with my grounding or the conceptualization of the discussion. And I was giving that example of ISIS liberalization because I know the proponents of freedom of choice, they do not want to take responsibility. And that is why I want to raise this as a fundamental issue. Because I want to go further, if we talk about a free market, how free is a free market? How free is a free market in terms of giving choices to people? Instead of converting people to think that this is right, because they can make more profit from people who are, well, not careful, who are careless. Because we must also protect that person who is bombarded with information in the house. That is why I think we must protect our children, even in their bedrooms, in terms of access to internet and other dangerous sources of information. So I'm raising this as a moral fundamental question of society. That the state should take that responsibility. So if you think about these free markets, I want also to tell us how free is the free market.
Right, the last one here, Honorable Montash.
I just want to ask the doctor, in his view, does a responsible government have no responsibility to protect its inhabitants from addictions, for instance? Because you've been saying in bringing it closer to our homes and ours, we will increase the participants. In the, as a responsible organization, don't you think the government has a responsibility to protect its inhabitants from exploitation, from addiction, because that leads to disintegration of families. And people who suffer in that process are mostly women.
Thank you very much. We'll be over to yourselves, Dr. Pretorius, if in any order to respond to the questions and comments.
Thank you, Chair. I will try and remember the order. I didn't write all the questions down. I left my pen at the desk. So to start off with the honourable member about choice, freedom of choice and responsibility. I'm not qualified to speak about, you know, children having access to the internet in general. When it refers to internet gambling, I do believe that there should be measures in place, should this be legalized, to prevent underage gambling, similar to what casinos have. So nobody under the age of 18 is allowed to gamble. So that is definitely a restriction that should remain in place. Just in terms of contextualizing the prevalence of gambling in South Africa, and, you know, about choice and responsible choice and freedom of choice. 50% of the South African population does not engage in any form of gambling. So 50% of the population chooses to be involved in some form of gambling, whether some of that is lotto, although the lottery board not consider that activity as gambling, or other forms of gambling like horse racing, bingo, you know, low-down machines and casinos. So 50% of the population would engage in gambling. Of that 50%, 95% are able to engage in responsible gambling and to, in other words, use this as a way of entertainment. So that is the side of the problem, just to contextualize this thing about responsibility. Maybe, you know, just to your last comments that you've made, I do believe that, you know, should internet gambling be legalized, it's happening in any event, there should be certain restrictions in terms of, you know, who gambles, how many accounts people have, and maybe amount wages. I'm not quite sure, you know, how that's done, but I know that there's an internet software available that can provide all of that information. And at all times, people should have the option to exclude themselves from an activity for a certain amount of time. The second question from the honourable member, I think that must be a mistake. I'm still not finding that slide 6 that is currently on there. Regulation is most unlikely to eliminate remote gambling offshore sites. Oh, I think regulation in South Africa, in other words, you know, we cannot be sure that other sites will not be operational in South Africa because of the creative ways that people find around internet service provider restrictions. So it is regulation. So although even if we regulate this in South Africa, this will not prevent other illegal operators, you know, operating on South Africa and on the internet. So I think that's just the point of, you know, that I wanted to make. So we will at least, you know, regulate certain activities and have legal operators in South Africa hopefully motivate people to rather make use of legal sites where there are certain restrictions and other safety measures put in place. The third question was around research, if I remember correctly. Yes, in terms of what research we're recommending. Firstly, we don't know how big the problem is. I think earlier that the people that call our line, you know, from that group in the last year, 3.5% engage in internet gambling, but that doesn't mean that is how small or how big the problem is in South Africa, because we simply do not know. It's never been investigated, it's never been assessed. You know, so we would have to get our head around, you know, how we do such a prevalence study, but I'm sure it is possible. That's probably the first thing that we would like to investigate. How big is the problem? In other words, where do we focus our efforts in terms of psychoeducation and making people aware of the potential dangers? The next question from the honourable member at the back was around banning or prohibiting. I think I made the point that our organisation, which is a not-for-profit organisation, is gambling neutral. So, you know, we are much more concerned about the illegal activities that are taking place. And the people who call us who are internet gamblers are those people who have been caught out by South African Reserve Bank when they win. And it's not when they wager the money. So it's not when an amount is paid over into an offshore or an overseas account to engage in gambling, but it's normally when people win. And so I don't know if there's a limit, or you know, if it's over a certain amount that there is, that star will pick it up. But certainly, you know, people, you know, the majority of the people that contact us have actually landed in trouble with SARB because of illegal gambling. So regulation, I don't think it's easy, but it's preferable to illegal gambling. I think then, Chair, you asked the question around how do we protect the young. You know, and I think the first member who raised the first question. I think you raised this question, the issue first. So, you know, how do we protect people? And unfortunately, we cannot protect, you know, every single citizen of this country against everything. You know, but at least in terms of activities where you should be over age to engage in those activities, such as drinking and gambling, there should be protective measures in place. And that's the protection of the youth that I was referring to. I don't think, you know, we can entirely protect our youth, although we would love to protect them against all kinds of risks. Just as a comment, the NRGP has a schools program where we have specifically, as part of the life orientation curriculum, have developed two programs, grade 7 to 9 and grade 8 to 12, 7 to 9, 10 to 12, on risks. So it's not about gambling only, but it's, the name of the program is called Taking Risks Wisely. And obviously our aim is to get that into all schools, and we do that through the various departments of education and the various provinces. So that is a very useful program to make young kids aware of the, you know, the risks that they are open to. The last question from the honourable member at the back of my side, if I remember correctly. The question was, does government not, because we know that this is a potentially harmful activity, you know, should we not prevent that activity? I think, you know, my answer to that question is, it's happening. You know, it's like, we know that if it's not being regulated to protect people, it will go underground, as it currently is. Where, you know, when it's the service is provided by an illegal or a criminal group, you know, the harms are probably a lot bigger than what the harms that we can manage. And again, remember, the small percentage of people who get into trouble through gambling. I think if we look at drinking in the country, the people who get into trouble through drinking is a lot bigger. The problem in that area, you know, is certainly a huge concern. We focus obviously on gambling, although we get a lot of co-addictions, we do get alcoholics. You know, that problem should be managed rather than pushed under the carpet where we can't see it and we can't manage it.
Yeah. Look, Dr. Pretorius, having this input and it takes very different input from what everyone else is making, it is very valuable to members of the committee here in finally making an informed decision. Of course, certain things do worry me here, and we may, in fact, invite you to rejoin us when we unpack the policy in due course, you know, effect fully. As it were, around 5 August. But it worried me, and I did see that, Honourable Hilliard, you know, when one talks about your institution being gambling neutral, but please protect the minors. But they're not neutral there, are you? Otherwise, you wouldn't be asking us to protect them. And if not harmful, why should they be protected? That's what I'm wondering. Why not let them play with it the same way they play other games on that little iPad of theirs? So, I think the work that your organisation or institution is doing is invaluable. Let me say that at the outset. But I think that we would ask you yourself, I know that if you say, you know, you're not funded by government or whatever, but you know how to help it, but nevertheless, you acknowledge that more research needs to be done here and there, and We certainly would welcome such endeavours on your side. And also, it would appear as if some of your clients, because we're not your personal clients, but the institution, they seem to know how to get on the banking restrictions. Maybe they should have a word with Barca and your colleague at the bank here to get a few tips from these criminals and others, so that we also have insider information, as it were. Thank you very much. But thank you, Dr. Pretorius. Honourable Hill Lewis?
I just wanted to make another point to the doctor with regards to that point that you spoke on about offshore sites. Of course, it's true that it's never going to be possible to stop illegal sites from starting offshore and offering services in South Africa. But one would hope that if there's nothing stopping them from getting a license, that they would want to operate in a licensed environment where they comply with the law, pay their dues, and do business legitimately, unless they're an out-and-out criminal operation that doesn't care about the law anywhere they operate in any country.
You do have in text form, please let us have. Thank you. And then we're going to be asking, if I'm not mistaken, Cassandra, Casino Association of South Africa, who's been with us for years now. Hey, where am I, you? Casa. First time I saw Casa, I thought it was Italian for K. But there we are, the Casino Association. Right, thank you for joining us. I hope you're not going to tell us that you're of the opinion if you can't beat them, join them. So let's just hear about casinos, all right? Thank you. Chief Executive Director of CASA, Advocate Gibson, for advocates from her legal advisor to CASA, Mr. Fori, General Manager of CASA. Right. Now, I'm not sure who's giving the presentation.
All right, it will be me. I'm Alicia Gibson. I'm from a gaming law and compliance consultancy called AG Consulting, and I am assisting CASA in this presentation. Madam Chair, just two preliminary comments. The first is that unfortunately I'm in a bit of failing health at the moment. So if my voice drops off suddenly, please forgive me. Secondly, just to say that we try to condense the information that we're giving in this presentation as much as possible, bearing in mind the 15-minute framework within which we're required to operate. However, we just want to say that the sweep of information behind information is very large indeed. So we will do our best to provide as full a picture as we possibly can in the brief time provided. First on issues of principle, as far as CASA is concerned, its position is that it's neither for nor against the licensing and regulation of remote gambling. We regard this as being a decision that is a policy one to be made by the South African government. However, subject to the fact that if that decision is taken, it's important that the government, bearing in mind two options, namely to maintain the status quo with regard to online gambling being legal, but then it would be incumbent on government to ensure that that legality is comprehensively and properly enforced, or to legalize online gambling, but then to ensure that it is subjected to strict and proper regulation. We also want to say that increasingly, and I'm talking about with exponential increases every day, every week, every month, every year, illegal gambling is growing in the context of internet gambling, and it is a major threat to the licensed legal industry in this country. If the country does decide to legalize and license and regulate online gambling, it's very, very important to ensure that the legislation will provide first of all for a practical and an effective legislative and regulatory dispensation, that it will avoid potential hazards of regulation of the sector, especially in relation to participation in offshore gambling with offshore operators by players and by minors, that it puts in place proper compensatory measures to ensure that the laws of other countries are respected. You have to take into account that what you're dealing with is a borderless, huge conglomeration of networks where you are transacting remotely with people all around the globe who are subject to the laws of their own jurisdiction. And that you have to, as a responsible global citizen, have to ensure that if you're going to regulate this activity, that you create mechanisms in your legislation, I'll get to that just now, to ensure that when people sign up with you, if you license somebody in South Africa, that there will be no prospect of that person engaging or signing up as a patron, a person who is a citizen of a country that does not permit its citizens to contact offshore with other online gambling providers. Now, unfortunately, if one looks at the bill from the perspective of these objectives that we have highlighted here, we submit regrettably that it fails in a number of very important respects. I've included this picture on this slide to give the committee the sense of a very important picture. And in fact, I don't know if it can be made enlarged. I wish it could. But it is a map of Europe, and it's drawn, and the one that you see on the left is the map in 2009, and the one that you see on the right is the map in 2012, and bear in mind, of course, that we're currently in 2015. Now, if you look at those, the orange, the predominant orange on the right-hand side, that is now representing jurisdictions in Europe that have elected to license online gambling and keep it local. In other words, what they've done is they have said, we will license this activity. You look on the left, you'll see how few of them there were in 2009. Now almost all of the map is taken up by the orange. They have said, we will license this activity and we will only permit our own citizens to engage in this activity with people who are licensed in our own country, either in our own country or in the European Economic Union as a whole. Now, if you look at that, you'll see, for example, the United Kingdom, which is green there. That is now orange as well. At that stage in 2012, the United Kingdom had what they call the whitelist, and they allowed operators from a variety of jurisdictions that were whitelisted to offer remote gambling based in the United Kingdom. However, the government soon saw that, hang on a minute, we're losing revenues. All the revenues are going offshore. And therefore, what they have done in 2014 is they have now said, no, we are now passing our own legislation. You will not offer UK citizens remote gambling unless you are licensed in the UK. So what you will see, if you look at the whole world stage, you'll see that governments have realized that this is an activity that is growing, demand is therefore. People are going to engage in this activity and they would rather keep their tax revenues within their own jurisdictions. And that is why you see the picture that is being drawn now of so although the internet is borderless, and although you think that you will have capacity to transact with anyone anywhere, that is truly not the case. So the world is becoming, in a few years' time, I would predict that the world will be going to an internet casino, will be going to a geographical casino, because the laws of the country will prohibit you from going elsewhere in your own jurisdiction. So it's an ironic kind of situation, but that is what world trends will tell you now and are expected to become far more pronounced. In addition, it's important to note, and I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the consequences of non-compliance. For example, in Costa Rica, it must have been about 2006. They had an unregulated market, but there were many remote gambling operators in Costa Rica, and one of them was a betting operation headed up by Mr. Alex Carruthers, who marketed various sports betting products all over the world. And people in the U.S. took place with this particular company. And when that gentleman, Alex Carruthers, set foot on American soil in Texas in 2006, he was arrested and ended up spending 33 months in an American prison for offering remote gambling to United States citizens. So one has to understand this is not something that is to be trifled with. So that is what you have in the world now is a point of consumption approach, where you will view the activity taking place, where the player is located, and it will be regulated in accordance with that. Now, as far as the law itself is concerned, we know that there's an absence of proper and meaningful controls to prevent prohibited persons. When I talk about prohibited persons, I mean persons from other jurisdictions who are not permitted to engage in remote gambling with offshore operators. Now, there are not sufficient controls in the board to prevent this. Here, for example, if I refer to Clause 16.3, there are no assurances that a player is participating legally prior to registration, and it is reckless to allow contention made by the player regarding his or her primary residence. See, what Clause 16.3 of the bill says, if the person located outside of South Africa may register as players with South African operators. And Clause 44b4 requires South African operators merely to refrain from making a payout to a registered foreign player unless that operator has obtained and recorded a statement from the player confirming that the law of the country within which a player primarily resides does not prohibit the player from playing or engaging in remote gambling activities. Now, these are irresponsible provisions. These will not pass international muster. First of all, you can't register a person unless you have gone through a series of verification procedures. It's outrageously aggressive to say, I'm going to register you, but I won't pay you. I'll let you engage in online gambling, but I won't pay you until I've obtained a statement. And moreover, it's also rather reckless to rely on a statement file from the player to say, look, I primarily reside in X, and to rely on the player's say so that the laws of his or her country do not prohibit him or her from engaging in this type of activity. So the law really needs to be, if it's going to go through, it really needs to be tightened up from those kinds of perspectives. So the onus should be on the operator. Whenever a regulated remote gambling operation, there should be a very specific and particular provision in the legislation that says, before you sign up a person, you must have verified the identity of that person, you must have verified their age, you must have verified that the patient is a citizen of a permitted foreign jurisdiction, in other words, one that does not prohibit its citizens from engaging in that activity. You must have verified that the patient is acting as a principal and is not restricted in their legal capacity. And you must also verify that the provisions of legislation pertaining to financial intelligence have been complied with. If you have a system that provides for any less than that, you don't have a proper legislative dispensation. In clause 45.3b, once again, it shows that the draft is unfortunately just not perhaps proceeding from an informed enough point of view. Because it says that an operator can request any person suspected of being a minor to produce identification and proof of age. That should never be necessary because you should have done that before you register the claim. Then, as far as norms and standards are concerned, we've noted that I'm not going to go into detail of all the clauses because there's simply too much to be said, but it requires the NGB, the National Gambling Board, to develop a huge amount of norms and standards for the industry in general. First of all, with the preliminary observation is that one must be careful not to abdicate too much legislative power by handing over a chunk of the lawmaking function of Parliament to a body such as the National Gambling Board. The National Gambling Board does not, unfortunately, have any regulatory experience. If you look at the design of the national gambling legislation from the outset, NGB has never had a regulatory function, so it's going to be very difficult for them convincingly to be able to develop standards of this nature. As far as technical norms are concerned, it's going to be, with respect, almost impossible for NGB to develop these. It's a highly specialized task. We have technical standards in this country for a range of products and services, including game machines, central monitoring systems, that type of bookmaker wagering system. Those need to be led by experts. And then the gambling software needs to be tested against those standards, certified, and approved before they can be exposed for gain. Then what it also doesn't mention, which is terribly important, is internal control standards, because that is the way the industry operates. What happens is the regulator requires the operator to develop internal control standards. So you as an operator would look at all the legislation that applies to you, and you would then set forth your blueprints for ICS, or internal control standards, to say, how am I as an operator going to comply with those standards? How am I going to comply with those legislative and regulatory requirements? So it might well be that if I'm an operator and Mr. Lumesi is an operator, we might come up with different internal control standards to say how we're going to meet the requirements of the legislation. But you don't need, as far as operational, as long as you mitigate all the risks, then you don't need to have the same internal control standards. So to say that you need to have single uniform standards for operational procedures and controls is not correct. Then, as far as the scheme, regulatory scheme of the bill is concerned, it's pretty structured in terms of the way it addresses the regulation, the licensing and regulation of the sector. I would just mention that I was previously a regulator myself, so I'm coming from a position that of a certain amount of knowledge and experience. One cannot give an application, investigation, protein, and day-to-day regulation, regulatory function to a provisional licensing authority, and then give the actual licensing authority to a separate body in the form of the National Gambling Board. It will never work. The person that licenses must be the person that investigates and must be the person that regulates. You're creating an artificial distance between your provincial licensing authority by expecting that person. What you're effectively doing is you're expecting that person to investigate the applicant, decide whether the applicant is suitable, then make a recommendation to the National Gambling Board, say, all right, National Gambling Board must license the person. But as soon as the person's been licensed, it's back to the provincial licensing authority to regulate. Then if the license is to be suspended or revoked, cancelled, then the provincial licensing authority, who has all the information, must go to the National Gambling Board and say, you must suspend or revoke. The National Gambling Board doesn't have any knowledge of what the provincial gambling board has been doing. It's a complete mismatch of functions. You need to condense these functions into one body, one way or the other. It promotes second-hand decision-making by the NGB, or at the very least, a pronounced duplication of effort and resource. And other issues, the definition of remote gambling is, in our view, too wide. We suggest that what you need to do is look at the nature of activity that you're regulating. I'd like to just illustrate this by a small example. For example, if you have a telebet account with the host, for horse racing, and you pick up your telephone and you take a bet on the host, in terms of the bill, this would be remote gambling. It can never be like that. The telephone is just a mechanism, and so is the internet. It's a mechanism to engage in a particular type of transaction. Where you should be looking at remote gambling, you should be looking at an activity that is itself generated over the internet, and of which the outcome is generated over the internet. In other words, if I go and I play roulette, then that game is a virtual game that is being generated on the internet, and the outcome is in that software. So it's not the same. We need to pick up the telephone and phone Pumalela, the horse racing operator, and say, I want to be on horse number 6 at Kenilworth. It's not the same thing as what I'm referring to when we're speaking about remote gambling. So there seems to be, because many bookmakers in this country, not only in the West, but in most of the provinces of South Africa, have an online presence. And it appears from the bill that the intention is to say, well, we've got under these order to be remote gambling, and therefore all these bookmakers, as well as the totalizer, will have to apply for the conversion of their licenses to remote gambling licenses. That should not be where the focus is for them. The difficulties arise in the context of the parallel powers that the bill provides for the making of regulations. We're very familiar with this. if you have anything to do with the licensing and regulation of gaming in South Africa. There are 9, 10 sets of different standards that people have to comply with. You have regulations in Limpopo, regulations in Mpumalanga, regulations in Gauteng, all over the place, dealing with the same subject matter, which are completely different in their content. And although an attempt is made in the law to try and separate the types of subject matter on which regulations may be made by the Minister of Trade and Industry on one hand, and various MECs on the other, this is unfortunately almost certainly doomed to failure. What we would envision will happen is that there will be 10 different sets of regulations dealing with the same subject matter. Also, in terms of the fact that you have to apply to a PLA, it means that people are going to be looking, there'll be different costs. So the costs in the Western Cape will be different from the park in Gauteng or Limpopo. You're going to get forum shopping. You're going to get people looking for the jurisdiction that's the most attractive or the most lenient in terms of fees, or costs, or laws. So that's another danger that's inherent in this type of approach. Then there are some impractical provisions, clause 45H. That, for example, requires a person who's an operator to prevent people who in any way have any kind of interest in an event on which a betting is offered, to prevent them from taking that bet. It's going to be impossible to enforce it in practice, and it's impossible to comply. Then clause 21.4 is not consistent with the Protection of Personal Information Act. It requires information to be disclosed to any person in connection with an application, and that does not link up with the POPI Act. And then there are also constitutional issues with all, for example, in clause 32, which provides for the summary suspension of licenses. You find that it's very difficult to get past the court in terms of constitutionality of that provision. And then just finally, on the various issues of policy, just a few words, and I'm sorry if I've been longer than I'm supposed to.
No, you've been very explanatory. Do take your time.
Thank you. Demand. In terms of demand, yes, there is a well-established demand, and that demand is growing all the time. I think it's really important to focus on, if you're going to talk about the question of harm, you need to focus on the market and the product offering. For example, what is the typical profile of the person that you're going to be dealing with as a patron? That person has access to the internet. That person has a banking account. That person has to nominate that banking account. So in other words, when you register as a player on the internet with an online operator, you tell them your banking details. They create a nominated account with them for you. Account with the operator, and your money is going from your banking account into your nominated account. And that's how you pay. So every time you pay, the money gets subtracted from your nominated account by an operator until such time as there is zero balance. When you hit zero balance, you can't gamble anymore. You've got to pull that account out again from your nominated banking account. And if you are paid, you have to be paid from your nominated account into your banking account by the operator. So one must be careful to think that this is, you can sit there all day and gamble. You can't do that because of the relationship between your actual bank account and your nominated banking account. It's not like a retail operation where you can go in and pay and pull money. It's a completely different setup. There's no retail footprint in the river gambling industry. As far as proliferation is concerned, one needs to look at the same kind of considerations. Proliferation is only really, if you say, I'm worried that these activities are going to proliferate, it's only really relevant in the retail environment. Because one website is enough. If you have one website in South Africa, with one licensed South African operator, the whole country can join up. It doesn't matter if you've got two websites or three or four, because the whole country can join one website. So proliferation is neither here nor there in the context of remote gambling. Then geographic location. Despite the borders measure of the internet, most remote gambling legislation, like I mentioned earlier, now use the point of consumption approach. Therefore, potential time bases are generally, if it's properly regulated, effectively restricted to the jurisdiction within which the operator is licensed. Economic viability. I'm sure that anybody would concede that from a capital investment point of view, the capital investment that you get from an online operator significant less than you get in the land-based casino environment. There's no evidence to show that this kind of activity is likely or even probable to be economically viable because all the costs are borne by an operator and all the government will get back is taxes. And if the government does regulate it, taxes will stay in country instead of going offshore. Social economic impacts. There are extremely effective mitigatory measures that are available to problem gamblers in the online environment. You can do things that you can do that you can't really do in a casino environment. You can do on the online environment. Players can pose restrictions in terms of time, in terms of the time that they will permit themselves to play, in terms of how much they will permit themselves to spend, in terms of the duration of their play. There are any number of the balance beyond which their account may not stop. There are a number of things that one can do in this environment that one can't do in the casino environment that make regulation much easier. Enforcement. Minimal enforcement problems are expected if there's effective regulation. The problem really arises where there isn't regulation. That's where your enforcement problems do come in. As I mentioned, the revenue from responsible gambling operations will remain in the country. As opposed to being diverted at all. Because if you look under what I have said and the problem gambling, you must acknowledge the problem gamblers, because they have a problem, will typically engage in remote gambling, whether you permit it or whether you prohibit it. So it's in the nature of the beast. So the nice thing, the regulation of remote gambling in this country would be based on the point of view of enabling people to be aware of the problems on the online context and seek help in South Africa. And those are our submissions. Thank you very much. If there are any questions, we're happy to deal with them.
Okay, thank you very much, Advocate Gibson. Just a couple of questions before turning to the committee. It sounds like you've spent a bit of time in this area, in this field. How many years have you been dealing with this area?
I was appointed at the Enhanced Council to the Western Gambling Board in September 1997. I did that for a year, also ended up doing a stint as the acting CEO of the Western Head Board. I then left the board at the end of 2007 and I established a consultancy. I have a partner. And I'm also active in drafting legislation internationally, specifically in this field as well. But we also service a number of clients in the South African environment in a number of sectors, casinos, bookmaking sector, LPM sector. So we have rather wide wings.
No, thank you very much. And that's Advocate Ngabindi next door. Is that right? Is also the chief executive.
That is correct, sir.
Thank you for coming here, both of you. Right, now turning over to members of the committee, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mkongi, any takers? Don't need to see the hands later. That's a Honourable Kalako, right.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Look, for someone who said in their first slide that they needed for or against the legalisation, the rest of your presentation is pretty against. But I'd like to deal with some of the comments that you made in particular. Let me just deal with overall thrust of your presentation, which was, I mean, there's a lot of valid criticism about some technical aspects in the bill, many of which I'm very happy to entertain and some of which, I disagree with. The point is that the bill is in a draft format and is before the committee in a draft format. So where the criticism makes sense, the bill now belongs to the committee, not to me anymore, but from my perspective, I'd be very happy to approve and buttress some of those clauses where you think they are inadequate, and where the committee agrees with them. Let me say I don't agree that with all of the criticisms that the bill fails to achieve these objectives. The bill requires that all players be featured with the Financial Intelligence Center, and I think they're actually presenting to our data today. I'm not sure if they did come in the end. But so your concerns about the identity of the patron, the age, address or whatever it is of the patron, that would all be dealt with by the National Intelligence Center, because they would be required to lodge a copy of their ID book, a proof of address, that kind of thing, the same things that one is required to lodge to open a bank account. They need to have a registered bank account with a legal and registered financial institution. And as you noted in your last slide, I think perhaps you didn't note that in the bill, there's three sections, might even be four sections towards the end of the bill dealing with player protection. And I think one of the things the bill is strongest on is on the requirement in terms of how licensed operators are required to protect players and protect minors in particular. So I don't agree with that comment. In terms of norms and standards, I don't agree that it's an abdication of legislative power. You seem to have contradicted yourself in the slide with respect to advocate. It's precisely because the development of technical norms and standards is a highly specialized task that it can't be done in the legislation itself. Because norms and standards change with changing technology and the global cutting edge of what is available and possible. And so it's necessary that that is done through regulation. That's always the case in every bill that Parliament passes. And you are the first to say Parliament must protect its legislative authority and must advocate that to the executive. But where regulations change or can change, have the possibility of changing on an almost annual basis because of the very fast-moving technology in the space, then it's impossible to do that in the legislation itself, because then we'd be bringing an amendment bill to Parliament every year. So, where you say that we advocate in legislative power, but then two lines later you say it's a highly specialized task, that's why it can't go in the bill. It has to be left up to the regulator. To say the NGB has no regulatory experience, I tend to agree with that, except that you must surely agree that in the absence of Parliament, which is certainly no more specialized, in fact probably far less specialized, the NGB is the body most specialized, most capable in South Africa to be able to issue those norms and standards. So if you have another suggestion, I'd like to hear it, but I don't think that there is any other body that is able to issue those norms and standards besides the NGB, and they need to ensure that they're able to fulfill their regulatory function properly. Then on the division of roles between the NGB and the PLAs, you come from a PLA, so I would have hoped that you would have understood the problem that you were in. And if you heard the discussions that this committee had last week, you will know that I made this exact point several times to the members in the committee.
Sorry, which one was that on hold on?
The division of responsibility between the NGB and the PLAs. The problem is that the Constitution gives the PLAs significant concurrent powers, or the provinces rather, significant concurrent powers when it comes to the regulation of gambling. Add to that the problem that you can't have online operators applying for 9 separate licenses in one geographic jurisdiction. That's a ludicrous solution. So what we needed to have is a solution that was constitutionally valid and would fall foul of the Constitution, but which still maintains the concurrent powers the Constitution offers to the provinces and national government. And so the solution we came up with is the one that you outlined in the slide. I agree that it's probably clumsier than what we would like if we started with a blank slate. We don't have a blank slate. And so we have to come up with a solution which will pass muster. The third problem is that it has to carry support of the provincial licensing authorities. We can't present a bill that abrogates all of the power away from the PLAs to the NGB and then expect them to support the bill. The bill has to go to the NGOP as well. So we have to come up with some solution which makes sense both legally and in that sense politically. And I think that this is a solution. I don't agree with you that we can simply give all the responsibility to the NGOP, because that's going to fall out of the provinces. So if you have another suggestion, then that's fine. Then on the matrix that you presented at the end, I agree with most of your comments, particularly I appreciate that you note there that there are, let me just find here, extremely effective mitigatory measures available to problem gatherers in the online environment. I think that's an important point to note there. All in all, and because look, the bill was first gazetted in, I'm going to have to remember now because this bill has been on the table quite long. I believe it was gazetted in about December 2013, so about 18 months, maybe just over 18 months ago. At the time, COTA was not one of the organizations that submitted comments at that time. And it would have been useful if you had done so, and we could have perhaps met at the time in the drafting process to include some of what you regard as shortcomings, and some of which I believe has merit, some of which I believe does not. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Mkopi.
No, thank you very much, Sir President. No, I also want to welcome the presentation from the association. Especially to welcome the number of issues that we have raised in the village itself, with the challenges that this house should look at. I'm particularly impressed about the areas that needed to be touching up in this bill. That will make it more stronger and also to have more this. Now, I want you to maybe in another language to explain to me that slide 7 where you were putting the roles of the NGP and the roles of the TLF. You see, you used a very nice language. You said it is a mismatch of policy. So I want you to go further on that and explain. Because this is what is the serious problem in most of our laws that you are adopting here, where you give more powers to provincial structures and less powers to national structures, and enforcement becomes a problem. And in terms of one united direction of the country, you find directions that are going this way. So I think we need a coordinated policy that we have a center, the center should hold. You know, because all the structures that are based on provincial legislation, they are making the country budget-wise. And it's very important to give us which way can we use to make sure that this mismatch is not there and we protect it as particular. You are raising a matter because it was an issue that I was trying to get into myself, that this online gambling is a threat to the industry if it's unregulated. And then if it's regulated, it is a benefit to the country. Yeah, I want you to go further and then you explain what you mean about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Nkongi. Honourable Nathid, that would be all their hands. I'm trying to get members to be disciplined. Honourable Kalato.
I'm covered on that point. Except just you see, what is good about this this presentation deals with the draft legislation itself. What I want to just get specifically from CASA, I hear what you're saying. Neither you are or are against, but you are putting your position which is of help to us. But I would want you to be explicit with all the information. Will it be, from your standpoint, will it be to you more safer for us as a government, with all the issues we have raised here and other presentations, will it be more safer for government to regulate this instead of saying, no, we'll prohibit it, it's illegal? In your view, because your argument to me seems to be, going to that direction. So it's going to be important to get it explicitly what will be your view on that.
Now, I made it clear, okay, please, I won't be taking more hands. And not in this round, you can comment at the end. No, not in this area. No, no, no. No, no, no. Honorable Max Pearson, no. Right. Can we turn to yourself, Advocate Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll deal with the first question regarding the observations made by the Honourable Bill Lewis. I don't want to engage in a lengthy debate regarding certain of the comments that were made. However, the point that I would like to make is that in the context of the abdication of legislative powers, one has to be careful that you don't give too much away. And when I talk about legislation, I mean either primary or secondary legislation. I'm talking about regulations as well that can be made. I'm suggesting that the key features of your regulatory dispensation and your legislative dispensation needs to be in either primary or secondary legislation. I understand that I think everybody here who has any connection with the regulated gambling industry understands how quickly technology grows, how quickly solutions develop, and nobody wants to be sitting amending your legislation all the time. That is not the thrust of criticisms that have been respectfully levelled here. The specialized task, that's technical standards we're talking about. Talking about the technical standard that is developed by experts together with the South African National Bureau of Standards, and is a standard against which gambling equipment and systems and software are tested, certified, and made available for use. So one has to, and that's why I said in the beginning that unfortunately there's so much behind what is on the printed word here. It's difficult to get it all in as quick as efficiently as possible. We don't seek to suggest that everything should be handed over to the NGB. However, it's still a tremendous problem to have this division of efforts between your PLAs on the one hand and your NGB on the other. Nor do I understand the provisions of the Constitution to. I'm not sure if I understand the point regarding whether the fact that the bill needs to pass constitutional muster, which of course I understand, but I'm not quite sure I understand where the argument is coming from. For example, if you had a national bill or a national act which dealt in broad terms with the issue of online gambling, and say, for example, that parental licensing authorities may license and regulate those activities, but set forth the parameters within which that could be done. I'm not seeing that would not pass constitutional muster. Now, it's not my position to come here farther and to advocate those standpoints, but just to briefly to address the observations that you have made. I hope, and then I need to mention also that as far as the point raised about Carter not having commented, that's now unfortunately incorrect. When the bill was published, I believe it was April 2014, we did submit significant, quite voluminous comments. Thank you. Mr. Andrew Ingo. Excuse me, sir. Okay, thank you. I'm going to leave it to Advocate and Betty to respond to the main question.
Thank you very much, Advocate Gibson. Thank you. Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. I think for me, it's just important to maybe elaborate on where we come from as CASA in terms of regulation of this industry. So I think first and foremost, it became important to clarify our position because we recently launched a campaign against illegal online gambling. That was in December 2014, which is running until the end of last month. And an impression was created that we definitely against the legalization of the industry, which is not true. So we had to just clarify that we believe that this is a decision that this government must make, taking on everything into consideration. The reason why we're here and making this presentation, and in fact, it's something that we carried through in the comments, both in April, in May, I think in 1 of 2014, and in December of 2014, was to say to government, look, you have to make this positive decision. But from where we are seated, you really have two options.
instead of you going to maintain the status quo and insist that it's illegal, but if you do this, unfortunately we've been very disappointed and discouraged by the Air Force to enforce the law. Quite frankly, we at this stage we're not convinced that it's possible to actually enforce the law because we've not seen it happening. The latest decision on this matter is the 2011 decision where an operator called Kissimmee Casino was shut down following the judgment of the Supreme Court of Appeal. It's been at least now, say, 4 years, or is it four, at least 3 years from then. But you would have had to make sure that online gambling is not happening, but it's happening. So, and that's the first option that come in hand. The other option is then to say, if you cannot stop it, then you better then legalize it and properly regulate it. And that's why we did it from. We provided a lot of information because, again, it was supported by our view to say, look, please make a decision. But the purpose of our presentation was to provide information on what is possible, what's not possible, what the advantages are, what the disadvantages are, and what's happening internationally. And I think that's what we tried to capture in this presentation. So, in my estimate, it contradicts to say, look, we need a whole no against, but then point out certain advantages and disadvantages. But I think that's the purpose of people's presentation, to say, this is the information you have a call to make. I think I'll try in certain court terms to have to cover the Honorable Galata and Kony in terms of where we sit and what our views on this bill are.
Ron, thank you. I'm going to call on Advocate Sandra Merva. Hello. Yes. From Parliament. What I'd like you to share with this committee, you know, the whole issue of concurrency and the issue of norms and standards, etc. The issue of secondary legislation, regulation. So if you could just share that with us. Is there any convention or constitutional clause here requiring or insisting that norms and standards are set by the national body in the event of concurrency, etc.? And can a minister, who would then be given the power to set secondary legislation,
does it have power to delegate that responsibility? Thank you. We'll come back on that. Let me allow the advocate. Yeah.
Thank you,
Chairperson. First of all, on the issue of concurrency, the Constitutional Court provides that provinces do have legislative capacity in relation to casinos, gambling, etc. So it means that provinces are allowed to make legislation on that issue. Should legislation be made on a national level that conflicts with provincial legislation, then the Constitution also explains how that will be dealt with. When will national prevail and when will provincial prevail? So that is not what concurrent means. The issue of providing for provinces in the bill in more of in my mind, in any way, more of a practical implication. It is not required in terms of the Constitution that national legislation in relation to Schedule 4 matters make provision for provinces to play a role in the legislation. It's not a constitutional requirement. But on the other hand, the Constitution also has a political background, and that must also be remembered. So more maybe from a practical point of view, from a political point of view, a decision might be made that it is necessary to involve, but then it will be fine. It will be constitutional. But it will also be constitutional if it's only given at national level. So in other words, there is no constitutionality concern either way. It's more a practical issue. In relation to norms and standards and secondary legislation, that is also a policy decision. It is something that this committee will have to consider, and I think in all legislation, delegated powers that are given to the minister cannot be delegated further unless it is made clear in the Act that the minister can do so. And of course, that, from a legal point of view, we caution against because already Parliament is struggling to try and regain control of secondary legislation. A committee has been established to do scrutiny and oversight over that delegated legislation. So to delegate that further, you know, there is a lack of control, etc., etc. The issue, however, of secondary legislation versus norms and standards, the issue of secondary legislation is that that is legislation and it is enforceable. It is law. Whereas norms and standards will be something very much on par to a policy that the department is putting forward. So it will be for the department to enforce it. It will be for the department to make sure that is what is complied with. And that, in fact, is why legislation comes into play, because sometimes policy can't be enforced without legislation. And then that is where you need it. But if policy can be enforced, and that can happen, there's a number of policies that can be enforced without legislation, then it is in order for policy to be there. It depends on content. So there I don't equip to tell the committee that look, norms and standards must be rather delegated legislation, or it must just be a policy document. That would be for the committee to decide what would be the best. What I can also add, the one issue to look at enforcement, the other issue to look at is the ease of amending. Primary legislation, most difficult to amend. Regulation, less difficult, but not necessarily, you know, overnight. Norms and standards is in a policy document, would of course be very easy to amend.
Now, I will take input on the CEO, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable McPherson.
No, no. You see, at the beginning of the debate, I said on the debate, because when you were introducing it, Chairperson, it was something that came to mind, especially when Honourable McPherson was talking about the support of provinces. Or the National Council of Provinces. Now, it went to my mind the question of tagging of a deal. Which tag are we going to use in this field? Which is going to affect the National Council of Provinces? And if we tag it 85 or 86, 87 impact, which will make even this country careful, that must go down to provinces. And that has been a nightmare of police legislation in this particular parliament. So I would like maybe to help us. The taking of this particular appeal. Thank you very much.
Honourable Lewis?
Oh, thank you very much. Is the advocate, is it Advocate Dean? Gibson, excuse me. Advocate Gibson. Thanks for the clarity on the legislation. I thought that you were objecting to secondary legislation, so I've got no problem with putting it in secondary legislation. I just don't think that it needs to be such technical and specific. Things need to come to Parliament on an annual basis. With regards to the licensing regime, let me say it again, if we follow your logic around points of consumption regulation and legislation, it would mean that operators would need 9 individual licenses in South Africa if they were licensed in provinces. You disagree? I don't know if I understand why the advocate disagrees. Clearly, we're not following each other here, Chair.
No, I know what you're saying, Honourable Hill Lewis. I hope now you feel you've given a...
No, no, but the advocate disagrees with me. I see a vigorously
shaking. No, well, look, we can disagree with each other, can't we?
No, but this is the important point, because that's the way that it's structured in the bill as it is. You cannot, it's ludicrous to have a situation where where operators must have 9 separate licenses to operate in one country. That's why I prefer the NGB to have a national body to have a single licensing authority. I'd like to hear why you disagree with that.
Honourable Hill Lewis, we've heard what you have to say, all right? Now, the decisions are not being taken now, we're exploring this. Honourable McPherson?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to pose a quick question to the advocate. Surely this bill is actually to the advantage of the industry? Because it allows the industry, casinos, land-based casinos, to in fact reach more clients than are outside the province where they are located. Could you please comment on that? Thank you.
We're closing off to the committee now, as indicated. We're turning over to both the advocate Van der Merwe and advocate Gibson in this area. If you could just tighten up there, would you like to go first, advocate Gibson?
Yes, as far as the Honourable Hill Lewis's observations on, I fail to understand why you would require a license in every province to enable you to offer online gaming. Because online gaming is, after all, online gaming. If I have for example, a book maker license in the Western Cape that entitles me to have online presence. I don't have to run to in other province to get the same license to enable me to operate in South Africa because I'm dealing with the internet. I'm not dealing with a geographical location. I'm dealing with something that is completely different. So I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Advocate Gibson. Otherwise, you must use the tea time, which is in 3 months.
Well, maybe we can discuss it. I'm not sure, but I'm not sure I understand your question. And the second question, I'm sorry, I did not quite follow what it's been on.
Honourable Matthias,
that's correct.
Can I just rephrase it? I said, surely this, the Remote Gambling Bill, provides an opportunity to land-based casinos to apply, like any other person, for people to play games on the internet. And in fact, that would be to their advantage because they would be able to expand their customer base from being provincially bound. And I just wanted to comment whether, in fact, they would support that sort of opportunity.
Thank you, Honourable McPherson.
Thank you. Current position has been set forth as far as this is concerned. I don't think any operator would however not welcome the opportunity to expand their presence in the online environment. But I'm not mandated to say. I don't know whether Mr. Edward and Gubezi wants to answer that more specifically.
Thank you, Vanderman. We will propose, in fact, the bill has already been declassified as Decision 76.
Another point that you should just comment on, perhaps you have already, I may not have heard you, Advocate Van der Merwe. Now, as far as I understand, this is not a draft bill, this is a bill here, and we can amend it. But it is a fully fledged bill. It is no draft. It's a bill. Is that right?
Yes, Chairperson. It is a bill. It's called a private interest bill 3 of 2015, which makes it a bill. But yes, it can be amended in this committee.
Here we are, changing the third private members bill. Is that correct? For this?
What the entity is proposing is that an operator can just go and randomly choose any province they want to get a license and then operate nationally. That is not a sensible solution. We must have a national licensing regime for a national product.
All right, that's the last in the section. Right. Advocate Gibson then pursue the rest of this argument during tea break. Go ahead.
I just want to thank the committee for the opportunity of being here.
Now, members, I want to make, but I see Pablo right back there, and I do not want you to get the impression that you are forgotten. Duplessis, we'll be taking you immediately after tea. You'll be able to come and pick up your things here during tea break. But thank you to you. And you can see here, both advocates here from CASA, that there is a need. And I would have really enjoyed and welcomed, and I think the committee would have, if all of those commenting on this legislation would have either isolated the clauses in particular. I think you found that helpful, didn't you, Honourable Hilders? We found it helpful as members. So it certainly is a good example to the rest. Don't just run this race here. Come and constructively engage. Thank you. Tea break for 6 minutes. I'll see you back in 8 minutes. Thanks. We've got Mr. Ramaphalo, Executive Director, Risk, Compliance and Business, Business Development. And then Ms. Matabula, Legal Officer at the back. Right. Okay, you're going to be presenting. Right, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members of the committee. I think we're not going to be that long. For example, I've explained this now.
one early part of the time. Go ahead now.
Madam Chair, I think we've got Ferradu and Closet on an option here. Vela, we are probably famous or notorious, if they want to show you look at it, for mainly offering products from Pasolini and Station Beyond, as well as many other spots. We are licensed or operate in 8 of the provinces in South Africa. By virtues of licenses issued for by the various provincial authorities. Madam Chair, I think we have submitted comments on the technical aspects of the bill during December 2014.
That's quite right, yes.
Intend to repeat here, but just to probably say, of the 10 points that we have raised, I think CASA has repeated 8 of them. And perhaps the other two, if I may, which I was not intending to deal with here, but for purposes of completeness. Section 45 of that bill, specifically Section 45.8, seeks to deal with players that are not part of the gaming industry, on which some information needs to be provided by the operators, which we think is probably very practical. And it also, by the way, in there refers to an activity which is illegal, as we stop racing. I just mentioned that point. The other point that Qatar hasn't raised will be my last point in this presentation, which is the taxation. And I mean, that's all, Madam Chair, on the principle. Our concern is that the legalization of remote gambling as a product, whether legalized or otherwise, has a potential to not only displace the gambling rent from existing operators, but to threaten the jobs that exist in the industry. You know, we talk about no capital and infrastructure investment. I mean, the technology behind this product, by its very nature, is less labor intensive. Now, if you have those kind of displacements, the fresh jobs will definitely fall. So we are, naturally, very much concerned. On poker gambling, and I'll probably that the point I disagree with Advocate Gibson on, when she said neither here nor there. E-commerce, by its very nature, I mean, you have a larger audience on which to play to encourage and get involved. And, the hours of trade are not restricted. I think all of us buy books and other stuff online, and the retail that she mentions would like to open more stores in addition to getting us to buy groceries over the internet. So there is an element that if a product is extremely available, the need for problem gambling, I think, will arise because you've got one more people and second, got unlimited access or activity by the very nature of that product. In terms of movement of funds, the advancement in the payment system industry, if I may call it that, as I said, very easy to top up your bank account right now and almost transfer the profits of that into whatever nominated other account you like.
I'm going to stop you there because you're getting softer and softer. We're very silent now. They can talk a bit louder. I know it's a technique some people use to persuade people to keep quiet.
Yes.
Okay, just louder.
Sorry about that, Madam Chair. So the issue of accessibility is, I think, what you say, creates a potential for problem gambling. Right. My last point in this presentation, which is also what covered in the bill as far as taxation is concerned, is we offer our product remotely, where customers do open accounts with us and place that by way of a telephone, internet, etc. Now, in 2005 already, we addressed a forum of CEOs of the provincial hearing boards as well as the national hearing boards. Even before the PXP case that Advocate Ngobes alluded to say, we are of the view that any such activity, because it's transport, requires a different immigration dispensation, which is a resident-based test. So the customer's FICA register address becomes the base from which the test is paid by an operator. And I think for the same reason, this should be a case to be considered here. Especially more so, we talk about funds to follow the source, the provinces will carry the socioeconomic burden and cost. And I think it's been mentioned a number of times, even by the National Responsible Gambling Program, that if customer A, who's located in the Western Cape, plays with an operator who's licensed to offer the most product in housing, and the taxes are paid in housing because the operator is in housing, and then the socioeconomic problems arise, if the Western Cape elevation that's going there to deal with that issue and pick up the pieces. And therefore, we think that needs to be given consideration as a way of finding an equitable distribution of the revenue derived from these kind of costs. And I'll hand over to Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, in essence, we're not about being against online gambling in perpetuity. What we're concerned about is jobs in South Africa is our highest priority. And the impact on the bricks and mortar casino sector and the bricks and mortar betting sector at the moment is unknown, if not most likely negative. And we think that, and would suggest that a proper study be done on that basis. Having said that, illegal online gambling is right. We believe that it can be policed effectively, and I'm happy to give you examples of that. I must also draw your attention and the attention of your Honourable Committee to the fact that what we're dealing with here is not only any form of gambling. What we're dealing with here is casino-style gambling, because the greater concept of gambling encompasses the national lottery as well as betting. And certainly, I don't know about the lottery, but certainly betting is legal. Every province allows it in South Africa, and we at Bumalela and pretty much every bookmaker have websites and call centers. So we conduct internet betting and we conduct telephone betting. What we're dealing with here is the more addictive forms of gambling, which you find in casinos, which is the typical slot machines, roulette, poker, pato banco, bingo, etc. So I wouldn't like to leave you with the perception that all of that is illegal at the moment. What I can say to you is that some 25 years ago, when betting on horse racing had 100% market share because all other forms of gambling was legal, as these other forms of gambling have been introduced, because they are more addictive, the market share of horse racing has eroded to the point where we are now 5%. So what we are also the most labor-intensive part of the gambling sector per million rand of gross gaming revenue. Now, we are concerned about this, the impact on our industry, because it's more addictive, because it's more available 24/7. And we're saying that in the face of a huge study that is taking place by DTI and by your committee, and really are requesting whether the timing is appropriate of this bill. I must also draw your attention to the fact that in most parts of the world, notably the US, with the exception of the state of Nevada, online gambling is illegal. I didn't come prepared with the facts, and I will substantiate them afterwards, but to the best of my knowledge, quite a few of the European countries still have online gambling that is illegal. And to the best of my knowledge, I haven't come across a country with unemployment figure as high as ours that allows online gambling. I unfortunately must disagree with Ms. Advocate Gibson, and I think the Honourable Bill Lewis is correct. First, the Big C case, you cannot only be licensed in one province and offer online bets across provinces. That's not what Big C says, and we have presented to the National Gambling Board as well as all of the CEO's forums recommendations that we follow the European principle of moving away from to national licensing, and to ensure that the provinces get the taxes that are due to them, that we move to point of consumption rather to point of production, which is what is followed in the UK. I must also point out that FICA is different from local gambling regulators, gambling operators, than it is abroad. For example, if you have a UK gambling license, you do not have to be a customer. As long as he deposits money from a legitimate bank account in the UK, you don't need to see him. And our operators locally would be at a disadvantage if the current FICA rules are perpetuated. Then just to illustrate to you, and this is our frustration, is the fact that the policing of illegal gambling is where we are at top. We recently came across Bet365 and BetVictor, who were offering bets to South African residents. We wrote to them and asked them to cease and desist. They did not respond. We then wrote to their regulator, Bet365 and BetVictor. We then wrote to their regulator, and we wrote to the Gauteng Gambling Board, and we wrote to the Reserve Bank. And they both stopped getting bets from South Africa. And I believe that the most effective way to get these people to stop betting is to write to their regulator. We have come across very few people who have a website and are not regulated somewhere in the world. Most of these people are regulated in Malta, Gibraltar, the Isle of Man, or one of the tax havens. But they all have very effective gambling regulators. And if you write to those gambling regulators that they are taking bets illegally from our country, those gambling regulators will take action. We don't even need to go through the Department of Foreign Affairs. Similarly, the Reserve Bank is able to alert the banks that these websites should not, the money should not flow to these websites. Thirdly, a campaign by the National Gambling Responsible Program or the National Gambling Board alerting funders, and I have seen certain such advertisements, alerting funders that if they do win, which is what we all want to do when we gamble, if they do win, the money will be confiscated if it's bet with an illegal operator. So what we're saying is South Africa, with its socio-economic problems of unemployment, should not be bleeding edge. We should not implement online gambling ahead of countries such as the USA, France, Holland, etc. We should learn from them and implement it in due course in a regulated manner. And in the meantime, we should use the industry. We'll be the eyes and ears of the government. We will report illegal activity to government, and government should do its job.
Thank you very much, Mr. Duplessy, and also Mr. Ramaphosa. All right, members, comment, question. Honourable Bill Lewis, Honourable Mkongi, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Quinhoff.
Thank you. First gentleman from Pumalela. Let me say the on the jobs argument. What I honestly believe, I mean, obviously we all agree that we must do what's best for the economy and for jobs and employment in South Africa. There's no question of that. The question is what is actually best. And in an environment where operators are operating online without any inhibition or prohibition in South Africa already, they are already competing with your operation and taking business and bets away from your operation and therefore jobs and investment away from your operation. The only difference is that currently all of their jobs, their call centers, their offices, their finance departments, their legal departments, all of the back office support operations is located in South Africa. And they're not paying any tax in South Africa. So that's what you have at the moment. So, with great respect, gentlemen, I think you but it's entirely the wrong way around. Currently, you are being undermined by online gambling. The bill seeks to put together a regulatory regime which would allow you to compete fairly, because all of those operators would be required to invest in South Africa, required to have jobs in South Africa, and be required to pay tax in South Africa. And let me just say on the point about higher taxation for land value, this is obviously a contentious point, but I'm absolutely clear on it. If there's a gambling operation which is more capital intensive and more job intensive, it should be incentivized through tax policy and not disincentivized. And I think I've been clear on that position in this committee for several years now. So, with respect, I think you've got the job argument the wrong way around. I think you're suffering now, and what this bill does is allow you to compete fairly. Then, on the question of online gambling as a whole, as you rightly said, your product is available online right now to anyone in this room, anyone in South Africa, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that is completely legal. And it's a legitimate business, no problem with that whatsoever. The question is, in the mind of an ordinary South African who doesn't know even one-tenth as this committee knows about gambling, there's absolutely no difference between Bet365 and your website. I forget what the website is called, but it's
Bet365 and Bet10.
No, no, what's it called?
Please?
I think it's Bet10. So, in the mind of the ordinary punter, there's absolutely no difference between the two products. They see a website, and really, in principle, what is the difference? It's gambling, it's available online, it's a legitimate business, both of them are legitimate businesses, and they should both be available. The legal distinction between the two is arbitrary. It's completely arbitrary. It's an imagined legal distinction. That's the kind of perversity of South Africa's bizarre gambling regulatory regime. So the whole thrust of the bill is to say that distinction need not exist, that you should be able to compete fairly. And this is the point that I forgot to make closer, but it's relevant to you as well. I firmly believe, and I believe there is research to show this, that South Africans would prefer to gamble on the website of a company that they're familiar with, and that they know has an office down the road that they drive past every day, than some unknown foreign website that they've never heard of before and they don't know where their money's going. So, you've got hundreds of retail outlets around the country where people go gamble all the time, and I'm convinced that they would be, in a fair competitive environment where you could be licensed alongside the people who are currently operating but are not licensed, you would win. And that's the kind of regime we're trying to set up.
Honourable Max,
then Honourable Max. Now, thank you very much, Mr. I also want to welcome the presentation from the two presenters. I'm taken about the possibility that this legalization can affect the question of one of our priorities as a nation. Matter of self-creation. And I would like to go further on that matter, because those things will also need some effective research on the implications, the direct implications of, but I'm making the argument that you're not talking about the wholesale indicalization. You are saying specific, you know, which strategies. Most of you. The question is the very same question that I asked. But the did not want to go into this debate. Because I wanted them to go straight into the issue. What is the strategy of fundamental threat to the industry? One of these fundamental threats to the industry is the question that is going to wipe up the employment potential of South African industry. But that is also so I like. So the study is very important for me. And then maybe we can go on and on to deal with that. Now, I want to ask, because you did not go into, when I started my debate, I spoke about the ethical, you know, and a few of Kenya in Geneva, and went into the question of the oil and Kenya. You see? But what are they, other than unemployment, what are the economic trends of online gaming? What are the economic trends that we have in South Africa? Because the question of economic development and growth is one of the fundamental challenges that are facing the country. So if we legalize this whole segregation, what are the economic trends that are facing? We see what you spoke about unemployment, or what are the other things? For example, can the infrastructure that is there in terms of the hospital and so forth, it can wipe out and become non-existent because of the of the threat of this online business. You can be rendered dysfunctional and go down. Now, you've raised the issue of the lack of investment in infrastructure, taxation, you know, problems in terms of taxation, and who pay the brand at the end if there are socio-economic problems, a particular problem, than what the person is making a bet. So I want you to go down into details about those particular things, and then this is the second round of the NJASA and Kenya.
Thank you very much. Where is Honorable Nathan Tosh?
I just want to say, I can't remember a time in a group in the industry came and gave a presentation and spoke on another industry's behalf. And what I heard is a horse racing entity come and speak on a casino's behalf as to why we should not allow online gaming. And that's quite strange, because I think for me what it is it's about trying to exclude competition, when in fact that what they can't see is that they are actually unfairly competing in a market that is unregulated and it has been today and now, and there's no consequences for those operators, illegal gaming operators, where there are consequences for you for abiding by the rules. And so I don't buy the issue of saying, well, what we need to do is think about casinos and, you know, the jobs that they have and that sort of thing. We need to talk about how it affects your industry. And on the issue of jobs, this policy on online gaming, or however you want to refer it, has been on the table for the last 10 years. The Gaming Review Commission found nothing about threats to jobs. So, there has never been a study put on the table that has differed any other way. There's no empirical evidence to suggest it. And everyone keeps saying, we need a study. But that's been done for the last 10 years, and nothing to dispute that has ever shown to be different. And in fact, all it's going to do by legalizing online gaming is actually going to increase jobs. Because what we forget is that what the bill speaks to is about making sure that the back office operations of online operators are based in South Africa. The call centers, the finance departments, etc., the Honourable Hill has spoken about it. In fact, I think that your argument about job losses is actually null and void. I think the issue is more about protecting an industry. You make the issue of problem gambling and extensive access. But what makes it any different to your industry, to what you have to do? I mean, online gaming would be subjected to the same regulatory issues that your industry is, and people will have the same kind of access. So I think that's somewhat of a non-argument. And I think that is the argument that provinces will carry the social, economic burdens and costs. They already do. That's why they pay tax. You know, taxes on alcohol, cigarettes, or gaming is to offset the costs of the state of that thin industry, of which gambling is one of them. So that's really happening. And I think that we can't pretend like now all of a sudden there's going to be a cost for the provinces where previously never was. So those are my comments, and I appreciate some thoughts from the two gentlemen. Thank you.
Honourable MacPherson, those could be described as employment taxes. But anyway. Never mind.
Could
I see your own hand, Honourable
Corrigan? I'll be quick. You know, with due respect to my Honourable colleague here on the left, I think it is in your rights to come here and comment on other industries, because you were, when the casino industry was allowed into South Africa, you were the biggest losers, and that is no doubt the case. I want to ask you, do you have done any research on what is the effect of the illegal gambling online? Is there any effect already? Because it's happened very reliable on it, in cyberspace, and it's with us. So have you done any study on that? And why not, if you haven't done it?
Thank you, Honourable Colonel, Honourable Mantush, and then over to yourself, Mr. Lipsy, and your colleague.
Just for comment, I have a problem with the notion that because this is already existing, why not legalize it? Why are we not legalizing housebreakers, if that's the case? We can't as a country that's kind of a high rate of unemployment continue to take a route that will wipe the base of employment in our country. And tomorrow we try to face the government that not create us. Why do we destroy them? I don't buy into this you say that, you know, going to the remote gambling will not wipe away our jobs. It will. It's a fact. You can't deny it. But people who take it what it is because they have not felt the heat, they have not come into the wild face of joblessness. History tells us who those people are. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Honourable Mantash. For myself, this is a short follow-up here, Honourable Hill Lewis.
You must just be careful to distinguish between legitimate commercial activity that takes place in the context of a responsible regulatory environment in an open society and things which are illegal and violent. And outside of the social contract. I don't think I need to go into more detail about the obvious difference between gambling and robbery and murder. So let me just leave it at that.
May I remind you, it is illegal at the moment. That's why you've got the bill here.
And they don't.
Just a bit on the ball, Natasha. I think we need to just keep that in mind. Trafficking of women and children and young men is also illegal, and yet it's carried on. So let us not go down that route. Honourable Mantash,
Please don't equivocate something which is deeply morally reprehensible and obviously wrong on an objective basis. Every human being in the world would agree, except perhaps the people, the very evil people that do child trafficking, that every rational human being on earth would agree that is objective wrong, morally and ethically and legally. Please don't equivocate that with an entirely legitimate commercial operation. Because then we would outlaw Pumalela and the casinos as well. We must ban it all.
Honourable Hill Lewis, I didn't want to interrupt you as you obviously are very passionate about this. However, you may not just ignore the chair. No. Honourable Mkongi.
Well, I think the situation is very nice, but if you are saying something is illegal, it is criminal. If you are saying it is criminal. So those criminals are the same as those of making Sakhar today because this thing is outlawed. It's illegal. It's illegal. But of course, I want to understand, I'm not sure whether I honorable Hill Lewis or is honorable what they say. I want evidence that head offices are going to be here. That call centers are going to be here. Finance is no. We are having a problem here of transfer pricing. We have a crisis here of many complicated things. yes, but I'm saying we have a problem where our own resources are sent to other countries where the head office are there, but only technology that is there is a satellite. We have a crisis. So I want to tell you this, that we say these head offices are going to be here in South Africa, these transactions, all of them are going to be here in South Africa, and these call centers are going to be here in South Africa. Because if you need evidence from other people to affect them, you must also come with evidence.
What I want to do is to turn to Pomelelo. We are running out of time. Please respond.
Madam Chair, again, if I may emphasize, we're not against online gambling in, gambling in perpetuity. What we're saying is it's premature, and we're saying that the impact on the existing legitimate operators and employment in the country is not understood and has not been proven. We are 100% on side with Honourable Gil Lewis that illegal online gambling must be attended to. We differ, and I will give a different analogy. I hate the speed limit as well, and we're finding it very difficult to implement, to abide by the speed limit. And the state finds it very difficult to enforce the speed limit. Are we now going to, because we're not enforcing the speed limit, are we now going to legalize it? We believe it's wrong. It's premature. What needs to be done is to, we need to understand what the impact on employment. We have a gambling policy where casinos are required to be a destination. They need to spend large amounts on infrastructure and employ large amounts of people in order to get a casino license. Now you give an online gambling guy the same license and pays the same taxes. That simply is not sustainable. I can say to you that we have, between ourselves and Gold Circle, we have approximately 400 bricks and mortar outlets and between us 8 press courses. We employ large numbers of people there. The minimum bet that we offer is 1.60 and the average bet is about 20 rand. The price in a taxi or in a car, the fuel, for you to send 20 rand to get to a betting venue is expensive. You're not going to go to that venue. You're going to sit at home and bet. So we will have to lay those people off. Let's be clear. The vast majority of the punters don't have internet access at the moment. They have telephones, but it's still third generation telephones. So we also, and in our submissions to the Parliamentary Subcommittee on Gambling, we make motivations for a higher tax for those gambling operators who are more labour intensive in favour of who are less labour intensive in favour of those who are more labour intensive. To introduce this bill without that is irresponsible. I must also point out that although Betting World's website can be accessed 24/7, sports betting and horse racing takes place at given times. So after 10 o'clock at night, there's very few sporting events that take place that you can bet on. Whereas if you just start playing online LPMs and casinos, these things happen 24/7. So there is a distinction. And what these forms are of gambling are also more addictive than ours. That's been shown in Turkey. You've mentioned that the licensed ones will win. Well, once we've got rid of the people, because we've got existing brand names, we will probably win. But the point is, it's going to be at the expense of jobs, which is a different policy. We were asked, why are we mentioning casinos and casino policy? Well, we compete head to toe. If you look at Sun International and HCI, they've got bookmaker licenses, they bet on horse racing, they bet on sports, they have LPMs and they have casinos. So we compete across the gambling spectrum. We are directly involved. I must make the point, we export South Africa, the picture of South Africa racing to large number of countries, some 26 countries, and there's a large array of websites where we all authorize them to web stream the pictures to punters in their country. So, for example, in the UK, Ladbrokes, William Hill, I think Bet365 has announced that they stopped taking bet from South Africa. We will allow them. But the point is, that they can geo-block with 99% accuracy the country in which they operate from. And they do so because if we supply one company in the, in the UK with our picture, we don't want them to supply another company. So we require them technologically to geo-block with 99% accuracy where that it can't go outside of that country. We are not, and we made a point on taxes. Mr. Kurnoff asked, Honourable Kurnoff asked us, the size of the illegal market, it's impossible for us to guess that. We don't know, but if we do come across somebody, if there is a willingness with the regulators to work with us between the gambling boards, the Reserve Bank and the external gambling boards, it is possible for us to stop it. And I've shown you two occasions where we objected, where we were successful. And we agree with Honourable Montas, although on a different analogy with the speed funds instead of.
Well, there are many differences. The fact of the matter is it's illegal. We should not be encouraging that kind of thing. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for your section, but you did submit a much larger written submission. Well, chambers, you all have. Now, please put your hands down. We're not going to have more of this. We're going to be taking two others. But I just wanted to remind members, this is not the only submission. There is a much larger submission which we've had. And as you say to them, I just think the point you made about the timing, a very useful, constructive one. But then over and over again, we come back to the issue mentioned by many of you at the moment, and that is a reference to other countries, but not bringing the study alongside. You know, you didn't bring it with you, etc. So it would be useful when DTI itself can also bring that along, a comparative study where such things have been entertained. You mentioned simply that, look, in Nevada doesn't have it, and it's not everywhere in France, Holland, and whatever. So those are the things in your broader submission. You did make a reference to that again. So we will come back, but we do need to press on. And I want to thank you, Mr. Duplessy, but also Mr. Ramaphosa. Thank you very much. And also, Mr. Matabula, Ms. Matabula, even though you didn't have to engage, although the duty of a legal officer is simply an insurance policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We need to have the next item, and that is the Lurie Incorporated Attorneys. I think Mr. Wayne Lurie himself is going to make the presentation. Is that correct? Yes. Okay. And then, where is Mr. Jan Weissman? Perhaps you could be kind enough to sit behind you or following immediately afterwards.
Chairperson, just stick with staff.
Are they picking up? Yes, Honourable
Colonel.
No, you're offline.
Just for the sake of time, can't listen to both the attorneys and then make questions.
I don't think you heard it. Right, you get, and then we've got the written submissions here, and I'm sure it follows what's over here to my right.
Yes.
Yeah. So do go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, just to give you a bit of quick background on where I've been sitting, I've been a practicing attorney in the sector for 12 years now, since 2002. I've consulted both with operators in every sphere of the gambling sector in South Africa, as well as many overseas. I've consulted regulators in South Africa extensively and further afield in Africa. I was also involved on the legal team in the PEXIC case, which is the only internet gambling case, if you could say that, in South Africa from 2003 to 2011. I went through various stages in the court. I was also invited by the then CEO of the National Gambling Board to join a committee that sat for the period of 2005 under the 2004 Act to advise the then Minister on policy in terms of the National Gambling Act 7 of 2004. And as many of you may remember, we produced a very comprehensive report looking at various jurisdictions, etc. And that was to be converted, if one could say that, into legislation within 2 years of the commencement of the Act in end of 2004. I was also consulted by DTI 2009 as a stakeholder, attended all the DRC hearings, very familiar with the report. And I added the last item to mention that, you know, to make my point that I'd run into members of the NGP in Gibraltar, of all places. I remember walking the streets of Gibraltar and bumping into two then executives of the National Gambling Board, and quite surprised to see them what they were doing, and they said they were doing undertaking research. So a great deal of research has been done, and despite, unfortunately, what was said last week by DTI, that more research is necessary, I cannot see how any more research is going to help us along the way. And I also wish to make a point, and as a lawyer, I think it would be remiss not to make this point, regarding the separation of powers between the executive and the legislature. And in this regard, I'd say that in 2004, that the legislature, this august body, prescribed that within 2 years, the minister would present legislation for regulation to be considered by Parliament. If it was to be that a prohibition or a state of prohibition was to remain, then one would have imagined that the Act would simply maintain the prohibition in terms of Section 11, which is the day you're at position that you're currently in, and not made a transitional provision to say that we will regulate. So I question whether the executive of being DTI has complied with this legislative imperative to present this legislation to this House. And I have to say, to some degree, made critical that 11 years later, we sit with a state of prohibition, a legal state of prohibition, while grey operators and legal operators fell into this market. And then we have talks of mysterious devices as a panacea for online gambling, devices that will mysteriously block online gambling and illegal operators into this country. I'm yet to see the advance of this nation. I hope to see it. I don't believe it exists. So I would really hope that this committee considers the issue of separation of powers and whether the executive isn't overstepping its marks in this regard. And moving on to my next slide, there are a lot of comments I could make on the bill. I submitted my comments, but instead I'd rather look broad policy issues. The key objections by DTR presented last week in dealing with policy are twofold. One, that prohibition is and if enforcement is more effective than regulation. And I've emphasized enforcement by saying that since the day you're in position in terms of Section 11, for the past 11 years, during which online gambling has grown from strength to strength in South Africa. And by that, I don't mean 50, who did, by the way, volunteer themselves to a civil process with the Gambling Board and the DTI, the second response, and said, we believe we as far as the license and the gambling takes place as far as that, but let's go to court as a friendly process. It was never a forced process. And if they want to take the approach of the illegal operators that have simply said, we're in Swaziland, that the others say we're in Eastern Europe or some island that curves out, and we're not doing this. So they were perfectly legitimate in the way that they had. The second argument forwarded by ETI is that remote gambling will exploit the impoverished and unemployed. And frankly, this is an incorrect assertion, and I will go into that in some detail in my slides as we go along shortly. I just chose one case study as to why enforcement is very, very unlikely to work in South Africa, why it doesn't work on an international basis, and why the general trend, and I might add that Europe is now mostly regulated. And I've been involved in licensing processes in Malta, Spain, Gibraltar, Italy, England, Scandinavian territories. So I'm starting to think of jurisdictions in Europe that aren't currently regulating. So coming back to prohibition and enforcement and the brief analysis of complete failure in the US, the interesting thing to note is that people are suggesting that UA, the 2006 unlawful internet gambling enforcement into law, was the definitive step in the prohibition of online gambling in the USA, and that's not the case. Effectively, in the US, before the internet, which coincided in the 60s, there was the 1961 Wire Act, which actually prohibited interstate sports betting. It's quite an unusual situation for us because we promote interstate sports betting, whereas they banned interstate sports betting and made it corrupt activity and a federalist felony. However, and I like that in the 60s, the internet was designed, and this is managed to communicate with allies across the Atlantic Ocean. And this is what you're up against when you talk about prohibition. Something that was designed to survive nuclear holocaust like a cockroach. So to talk about prohibiting it now with some mysterious device, I'm afraid that is as much science fiction as nuclear holocaust. Well, hopefully as much science fiction as nuclear holocaust. The issue of internet gambling was brought to the fore by Senator Cortal, who's still around in 1997, and he said, look, direct uncertainty relates to copper. It never contemplated the internet, and we need to remove the uncertainty and parts of that. And for 20 years, they've been debating it. And much like our enforcement agencies have tried, yeah, they could greatly affect them either because they're greater funded and possibly one could say fairly that they're better enforcement agencies under the Department of Justice in the US. They started putting a lot of pressure on intermediaries from 2002 to 2004. They said to the people advertising into the gambling, you can no longer carry this advertising, to the financial institutions, stop processing financial transactions, even to ISPs. Now, of course, there are constitutional issues which we would run into here, because the constitution is very similar, and they said, we've got to do something, and the only way they could curb it was to attack the intermediaries, the ones they could think of most in the financial institutions in 2006. Now, the next slide, I want to make this point, I know we're under pressure for time, but after passing the data, it took them 5 years to uncover and detect a financial fraud, which wasn't very sophisticated one at all. There was a legitimate operator called Full Tilt Poker and a couple of others that were forced into now seeking alternative funding to cater for the demand for online poker. All these people did is they set up online wall sites, online forums, and they started engaging in activity with uncoded transactions. Now, the Banking Association have discussed with us this morning, they've confirmed that they can't track, identify, and monitor transactions. They said that even the Reserve Bank can only detect major flows, and that there's no capability for proactivity, and they don't believe it's possible to block. Now, I fully agree in terms of my research that and understand that is quite correct, because how one identifies a gambling transaction is through a code that the merchant attaches. So when we use a hotel and we put our credit card through at the desk, it gives us 1, 2, 3, 4 code to identify this as a hospitality transaction. Now, in terms of the rules of the International Credit Card Association, they say you must code your transaction 7995, which some of the operators here, like Kumalela, will know they've got to identify this transaction as online gambling transaction. If people choose not to identify and just merely flout the rules in terms of the association, or even more nefariously, code it with something else, in other words, products or online retailers, you can get around it very easily. Even if you got on top of that, you would have to deal with the scourge of alternative payment methods or people just simply applying for offshore bank accounts and finding those with the offshore allowance of Africa's like for 10 million rand offshore, they can start putting into a bank account, have a credit card issue from them. All of these things might be illegal, and at that point, you're forcing the citizenry into illegal activity instead of catering for a demand which is there. And then, of course, there's cash collection. And it's just a simple method of going and collecting a bag of cash and then registering the funds with your institution. Obviously, that would be for a bigger punter. What we now have in South Africa, and the reality of it is, talks of the bison exercise, is we've got a rudimentary enforcement against players. And I emphasize, they can be caught. It's selective. And I deal with these people, as does my colleague behind me, on a regular basis. People that might be addicted to gambling, that don't know about the prohibitions, and they suddenly get served with this notice from the Reserve Bank, because the Reserve Bank has caught them in the net, as the Bank Association said. It might be a person who cashed in their mortgage who's really sick, and they are sick gamblers. As long as it's gambling, there's going to be problem gamblers and sick gamblers, and we've heard that. And they've gone and spent 500,000 rand on their credit card. And of course the Reserve Bank say, well, we've seen 500,000 rand sent from an American betting off a British casino, and we now find you untold amount of money. And I believe that is an unpalatable and bad policy of enforcement, selective enforcement. Not to mention that the Act currently creates a penalty where you can have 10 years in jail or a 10 million rand fine if you are caught as a punter on an illegal casino. Now, I don't think anyone would argue that you sent someone to jail for 10 years for online gambling with an offshore operator is quite extreme. And the final point perhaps is to say that what we have is at the moment in an environment of prohibition as opposed to regulation is we're allowing vendors, we have lost the battle against enforcement. I say that with absolute certainty. You will not stop people gambling online. And if you cut the path that comes in from outside of the country for the internet, we also, you're not going to have internet. You will not stop it. So we're allowing people to display their wares with impunity and we're punishing the purchaser. Now, it's interesting that the only people that have really gone out there to try and advertise this activity on radio, in the newspapers, at any meaningful level, are the Casino Association of South Africa. And that's laudable. But they've gone out to say to punters, do you realize the activity you're engaging in is unlawful? To try and create some awareness, even then it's not enough. And on that, the final point I'd like to make, I think it's been made so labor points, is that it's very hard for a member of the public, as Honourable Hill Lewis has said countless times, to distinguish between the legal site and the legal site. So apart from maybe a small disclaimer at the bottom of the site to say licensed by the Western Cape Gambling Board to provide sports betting. Ironically, when I mentioned sports betting, it prompts me that the US is the biggest sports betting, online sports betting market in the world. And there's a double ban on it. The first ban is the Hawaii Act that says you can't go across states on sports betting. And then, of course, there's the broader ban on the online stuff. Now you're talking about the FDR. That maybe I didn't emphasize the point enough. They took 5 years. 5 years to bring full tilt poker to book. And then withdrew a whole lot of their charges. It didn't go further. They let the indictments in place. They withdrew their civil charges. And full tilt poker was bought by a larger company called Amaya. And they still continue to operate, albeit not in the US in the way that they did before. But even then, they didn't take it to the full logical conclusion of that prosecution. Now, I just want to come to this argument about unemployment and impoverishment, and this is something I just simply do not understand in terms of the argument forwarded by the DTI. There are the highest barriers to entry for remote gambling, for remote gambling. I don't casino for anyone can walk in. You know, I've had the misfortune, because personally I have my own views on gambling, and I've had the misfortune, which I bring to this, but I've seen people in dusty overalls on a Friday afternoon ripping open pay packets and stuffing the contents into legitimate slot machines on a casino floor. It happens. And that's a tragic sight for anyone to see in any environment where a blue-collar worker squandering their pay packets that they've obviously just received at that. Now, if you look at online gambling, you need some form of device. We just heard from Marilla that most of their punters have third-generation telephones. How a unemployed person or an impoverished person is going to procure a cutting-edge smartphone to be able to go online and gamble is the first question. The second, though, is, and you might argue that the proliferation of technology will be such that smartphones are getting cheaper and the barriers to entry are such that unemployed people will have them, is that all of the bills that have been put before this House have suggested that somebody has to have a FICA-improved banking instrument or bank account. Now, how an unemployed and impoverished person will have that account in the first place, I question. But second, and then people might say, well, maybe they'll use airtime, maybe they'll use SMS codes. Now, that's an interesting example because in the cellular industry, it took many years, and I don't think it's been entirely correct, where people were getting levy subscriptions at exorbitant rates of these SMS things, whether they want to receive a ringtone or some other type of content. So, you know, it's that type of activity that happens in an unregulated environment. If you regulate and you supplement your primary legislation, secondary legislation, and say, you need a FICA-proof bank account, you cannot use airtime, you cannot use cash, however you want to structure it, you've got more chance of controlling and regulating it through that type of medium than just trying to prohibit something which is impossible to. I remiss not to mention something that's come up about sophisticated age verification and exclusion technologies. I've seen these technologies in action, and I'm sure they'll be able to be demonstrated to the honourable members if a fact-finding mission of that nature is undertaken, where you see someone in a call centre saying, hang on, this is a residential address that geolocated the customer. And something's alerted to them, the software, and it's brought it up to human beings and said, this person works 9 to 5. They should be at work. Let's phone. And it's a child on the computer because they worked out the time of day, where it's coming from, and there's something wrong with the way that the credit card's being used. There's such sophisticated technology available that can be utilized. And more so, I would argue, than somebody who might be 16 years old, passing a visual inspection, walking on 1604, and they're actually 18, because very rarely do they say, let me see your ID document as you walk onto my casino floor. Similarly, with exclusion technologies, as the doctor from the National Responsible Gambling Program mentioned this morning, there's this technology that exists that measures patterns. If you've excluded yourself, it says, what are you doing about? We don't want you to have said you don't want to come here, you're not allowed here. And measures your patterns and alerts the casino to things like rapid play, etc., etc. Sorry, I'm rushing through because I realize we have found these. On the slide of problem gambling, and I was quite pleased that the doctor I presented this morning, because her statistic matches up with the European statistic, which I drew from the European Gambling and Betting Association, where they see that typically the rate will be up to 3%. We must put a hedge on 3 or 4%. It seems to be in line with the international standard. But more so, they made the point that online gambling is not contributing to the increase in problem gambling. And in this regard, I think I'll say that if you're a pathological gambler, in the same way you might be a pathological drug or alcohol abuser, you're going to find your fix. Whether online gambling is bad or not, you're going to go and find your fix, whether it's on the casino floor, which operates 24/7, or on online sports betting. It's not going to change that for a pathological gambler. And I've given a URL there where one can look at the fact sheet from that, where I do that statistic. Okay, and then I've sat here and I've been puzzled at the confusion. You know, the NGB said that they currently weren't, there's been some mention of this from various different angles. The NGB mentions they currently weren't equipped to deal with licensing. And I think there is a problem and they probably need to tool up. But in the meantime, the way that the bill is currently drafted is that the PLAs carry out practical and administrative functions on day-to-day basis, and they currently do. I've applied for countless licenses from PLAs over the last 12 or 13 years, where they issue national licenses. Just recently, on behalf of clients, we received a national manufacturer's license, which is issued by the PLA, whether it's in the Western Cape or elsewhere, on behalf of the board. And I think that's where the bill actually bridges that gap in that peculiar constitutional situation where we have concurrent competency of the provinces and the and of course, to change that would require constitutional amendment, which I would suggest is a very complicated process. And finally, just a few bullet points on regulation. Our regulation, which obviously an advocate of, is well, we currently have standards for online gambling activity, whether it's the online sports betting, and there is, I believe, a standard that exists for online casinos. It's been in operation, it's been in existence for many years, because, as we know, this has been a stop-start process over the last 10 years. And those standards could easily be of an international level. We have test laboratories in this country to verify the bona fides of the software, which are international laboratories that are licensed here and have infrastructure here. So there's no discussion that the software would meet the standard. It provides for a monitoring and compliance function and funding for enforcement. But most importantly, unfortunately, I've made a typo at this point, so please excuse me. I've emphasized a licensed entity will always trump an unlicensed one because of player choice. If you present a smoker with an unregulated box of cigarettes of dubious origin that might even be cheaper than a regulated product, you'll want to know where that tobacco came from. The same thing with alcohol. If you have a choice between drinking moonshine or drinking a regulated product from a distillery, you'll do that. The same arguments applies to gambling. Why take your chances with an entity that might not pay you, where you might get caught in this reserve bank net and your winnings might be confiscated? And of course, you know, I think that makes great sense. So with that, I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present to this honorable committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Leary. We will be coming back to you to engage, but we're going to be asking Mr. Weitzman of Weitzman's attorneys to come in immediately with his submission. Just one comment while this is being set up, Leary. I'm just a little bit surprised, one comment that you made. I'd be interested to see, Advocate Leary, where your evidence is, because our own evidence, which comes from France and etc., with respect to illegal tobacco, illegal cigarettes, There's not a question of, no, we won't do that. It's a question of, my gosh, I'm saving 20 rand or 10 rand. So I'm sure they'd be interested to hear where you got your evidence from.
Madam Chair, I'm not expert on the tobacco industry. I have made that remark frequently. I can comment on alcohol. I haven't enjoyed it. No, all right. Thanks.
Okay. Over to yourself, Mr. White.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us the opportunity to make submissions today. I have, in fact, worked very, very closely with Mr. Lurie for the last, 12 years, almost 13 years. Both he and I share very, very similar experiences, some peculiarities that are peculiar to each of us, but both of us have been practicing for quite a long time, roughly 25 years together in this field. I myself have been an attorney for close on 20 years. I've practiced both in London as well as in South Africa. I've been a partner at firms in South Africa, been very blessed with a very wide-ranging experience all over the world. Both Mr. Lurie and I have in fact litigated industry-related matters in the UK, the US, and in fact Mr. Lurie started and I ended up finishing off the leading matter out of Germany to the full bench of the European Court of Justice. We both acted for parties locally, and suffice it to say, for the most part, other than perhaps these pronunciations on the issues of tobacco, I actually concur wholeheartedly with what Mr. Lurie has had to say and what he's presented. I am conscious of the fact that we are somewhat pressured for time, so I'm going to try and restrict myself to certain things that really are not peculiar to the bill, but trying to, I suppose, bring across my experiences within the industry, my view on it as I'd like to think a recognized expert in the field. I do appreciate, first and foremost, having practiced in this industry for a long time now, that regulating and determining what one's policy position on a so-called sin or adult industry is extremely, extremely difficult. You know, we heard earlier, for example, that the Lotteries Board doesn't regard lotteries as gambling. But if you look at the definition of what a lottery is and what a gambling game is, it's effectively the same. Policy as to gambling, in my experience, is a lot of gut feel and a lot of what we regard as acceptable. But let me remind the members of this committee, we have gambling in this country. We have a multi-billion rand regulated industry. And I'm going to ask you to hold that in mind because of certain things that I say later. And what I'm going to try to do is bring some of the legal aspects to it more so than the policy aspects to it. I'm an advocate of regulation. I do not favor prohibition. I believe that bona fide operators, and this is in my experience, representing parties all over the world, will be faced with these issues. And when I say bona fide operators, I mean operators who are licensed by other jurisdictions, have got no issue with being regulated, have got no issue with being regulated in multiple jurisdictions. In fact, most big operators are regulated in multiple jurisdictions, and have got no issue being regulated. So there is a growing trend internationally towards regulation that is absolutely inarguable, and it's accepted by these operators. Bona fide, and I call them bona fide operators as opposed to, for want of a better expression, skeleton operators, are already bound by strict advertising codes, strict anti-money laundering rules, and very, very strict player protection requirements. What I can say almost definitively, and I remain subject to being questioned about this and argument on it, but definitively, is that if one, as a South African player, legal or not, goes and gambles with a bona fide operator licensed in another jurisdiction, that player is no more at risk and no less safe than if we're licensing that party. I've dealt with regulators all over the world. I know the regulators in most of these jurisdictions. In fact, you know, in Aldi, for example, Andre Wilson, who's the CEO of the Aldi Gambling Control Commission, is an South African and well known. You know, Phil Rio, who's the head of the Gibraltarian Gambling Commission, is ex-Metropolitan Police officer as well as ex-UK Gambling Commission. These are people who know what they're doing, and they are very, very harsh and keep very tight controls over their licensees. A licensee from Curaçao, that may be a different issue altogether. But from certain jurisdictions, the players are not unsafe. Bona fide operators, in my view, and in my experience, and from everything that I've been told, are happy to come here and to be regulated here. They're waiting for the opportunity to do so.
Thank you.
Now let me say this, and this is a point that's been made before. Regulation allows one to regulate. It's as simple as that. Prohibition does not allow you to regulate. Regulation allows you to impose proper rules for the conduct of these activities. Or we're going to have to prohibit, and these things are still going to happen, and we're going to be reliant on others to create certain rules for us. That's as simple as that. We are not going to get away with prohibition. Sorry, I just want to adjust these slides very quickly. It's not my forte PowerPoints. The driver for regulation, quite frankly, is largely irrelevant in my experience around the world. Some want to regulate to protect players. Others want to regulate to raise revenue. Invariably, whatever the actuating mechanism is, the other follows. So, for example, in Italy, when there were earthquakes in northern Italy, Italy brought in a second round of licensing for remote gambling and in turn, they said, we need to raise the price to aid recovery. And, of course, player protection mechanisms follow on that the moment you have a regulatory regime. And, obviously, if you bring in player protection regulatory regime actuated mechanisms, you're going to invariably raise revenue. It doesn't really actually matter. At the end of the day, players do have to be protected. There is absolutely little doubt that problem player behavior can be more quickly and effectively identified in an online environment. I wholly concur with what Mr. Lurie has said. I have been in similar situations. The technology is extremely sophisticated, remarkably so. I'm not convinced, again, this is just my view, that more harm will result by regulation, as the DTI would have it, or that the number of players who currently play online will materially increase. I also question whether the demographic of persons currently playing online is the same as those desirable to view as vulnerable and to protect against proliferation. No doubt it will raise further funds for the focus, even if yesterday the Honourable Member Mr. Hilder said it redirects current untaxed activity to be taxed. In my experience, it is highly unlikely that prohibition can be effectively enforced despite anything the DTI offers. I have to say, I chuckled yesterday when the DTI, I say this with the greatest respect, mentioned that it was under device. In 12 years, I've never seen the device. I don't know what the device is. I'd love to know what the device is. Also, the question of, what is the banking association going to do? We heard from them this morning. There are practical difficulties in implementing. What are the ISPs going to do? Who we haven't heard from, I think, in all the time we've actually had hearings over the last however many years, I don't think we've heard from them. How do they feel about freedom of internet freedoms? Certainly in all the cases that we've seen involving, for example, in Kentucky a few years ago when domain names of casinos were seized as gambling devices, which almost 8 years later continues through the Kentucky court system, the Internet Freedoms Association got involved. How far do we go to stem adult behavior in a constitutional democracy? I agree, it's highly undesirable to prosecute players. In Australia, for example, where the law allows one to prosecute players, the Australian authorities said in terms, we do not regard it as desirable, we're not going to do it, despite what the law says. This is a question of policy, it's a balancing act, and we need to, the big thing for me from a pure legal point of view is, how do we resolve the fact that there's been a steady increase in the rollout of multiple forms of gambling over the past decade in SA, with us now wanting to prohibit this particular, prohibiting and wanting to sustain the prohibition on this particular form. It doesn't have any logic to it. The distinction between the forms of gambling that are currently licensed and those thought to be licensed, in my view, are arbitrary and capricious from a legal point of view. The GRC says much in its report. In the Holland casino matter in the European Court of Justice, the court took a similar view, not about South Africa, but about the perpetuation of other forms of gambling by state monopoly and preventing other new entrants into the market on the grounds of public health. Now, public health is for protection. It's not even a question. If we're worried about that players are going to be addicted, that it's going to become a problem or proliferate for more people, that is public health. And that's the argument. The European Court of Justice says you go and increase your monopoly, you allow other forms of gambling, or you allow existing forms of gambling to increase the advertising, to carry on rolling up new forms of technology, to really increase their business, and you're saying you want to keep other people out on the grounds of public health. The ECJ says that's devoid of any logic. You cannot do that.
It took a similar view in the German and including the carbon media matter, which both Mr. Lurie and I were involved with. The World Trade Organization, in the matter between Antigua and the US, took a similar view. I was involved peripherally in that matter because a client of mine actually acquired a company that was driving that matter with the Antiguan government. The World Trade Organization appellate body found against the US. The US's actions basically obliterated the Antiguan industry, which had licensed online operators. They are currently in negotiations to determine what reparations the US is going to be paying Antigua. Let me say the following. We have certain obligations, and I know Professor Kelly, in prior submissions a number of years ago, I think 2007, warned against this. Professor Joe Kelly, who both Mr. Lurie and I know well and worked with for many, many years in respect to certain aspects in the US. We may well be contravening our international law obligations. What we're doing is making decisions that don't really make sense for a court. And I've just got to pass legal muster. It's as simple as that. I don't believe we can look at certain countries. I have put it on my slide. Sorry, I get somewhat distracted with the with this. With other countries. I also think that, and I'll get to those now, but we've got to also be very careful about, for example, the chart that Carter put up, and I say this with the greatest respect to you, for a very close colleague, Advocate Gibson. The drivers for regulation in Europe are different to the drivers for regulation over here. The setup in Europe and the way that the European Federation works, Union Federation works, and the guarantees that were given in the Treaty of Rome to member states and their citizens do not necessarily apply here. There were state monopolies in Europe, but we also where states allow certain forms of gambling. Then the internet comes up, and despite anything that the Treaty of Rome said, which guaranteed certain freedoms of movement of goods and of people across the Union and freedoms of establishment, states try to hunker down and protect their monopolies. This resulted in a string of cases in the European Court of Justice over very, very many years and European Commission infringements. States have regulated, yes, but those regulations have to defer to certain things within an EU situation. Now, to say that the UK has given in now, for example, and has departed from its rightless position, was not because of anything other than that was the way the EU was going. And they decided, you want to be in that, you get a permanent consumption test as well. What I'm saying is there's a lot more to it than one would see on the face of it. And if we're going to actually look to those countries as benchmarks on the regulatory side, there's a lot more that one needs to know in formulating the policy. A lot more. You know, there was mention made of Singapore. I've been to Singapore. It's a wonderful country. Even chewing gum is banned. The T-shirts they've sold, they say it's a fine city. It's a benign dictatorship. You can't use Singapore to measure the mores of a constitutional democracy. Likewise, you cannot, as to permissive activity. The same would go with China. US is largely conservative. I don't want to waste time talking about David Corrales and Ben Osport and Peter Dix, who was the chairman of Sporting Bet, who was arrested. But, you know, that's stuff to consider. But there's substantial issues of law that actually need to be considered. And you need to consider whether the prohibition or the regulations are legally sustainable from both the local and international law perspective. I question whether the DTI has actually properly considered this. I question what the DTI believes is the material and the feasible distinction in law between current land-based casino and poker activities and, for example, virtual racing and the equivalent online gambling activities. Apart from the rationale, basically, is you can be permissive, but well regulated and taxed, or a total ban is tolerated as a matter of law internationally, but you can't be half pregnant. It doesn't make sense as a matter of law. My final submission is that whatever the policy is ultimately adopted to be, it needs to be clear. It needs to be enforceable. It needs to be legally defensible from an international and local law perspective. It has to be sensible within a constitutional democracy that we are and reflect the mores of society that this House regulates and legislates for. And it has to be well-reasoned. That is, it has to be not arbitrary and capricious. Ultimately, I think that the Honourable Member Hill-Lewis's bill
give us a very good groundwork from which to work in order to work towards regulation. That's my submission. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Well, thank you.
Very much.
Thank you.
One,
and I'm glad you've just come to the fore, Advocate Lewis. Thank you. Now, I'm going to immediately turn to members, and I'd like to look at, see the hands first before I... I'm sitting up for me to manage the time. Honourable Hill Lewis, followed by the Honourable Elvis. Any other... Is anyone else with a hand up? No. Right. Thank you.
I just wanted to use the opportunity to make one point and ask a couple of questions to the gentleman who presented. Firstly, I want to on the kind of proliferation in this committee of unanalogous analogies, if you would grant me that term. The previous speaker made an analogy around the speed limit. Speed limit is a regulation. Driving is legal, but it is subject to regulations which the government is entitled to submit, and it is subject to licenses being issued to those who wish to drive. So the analogy with respect is unanalogous. What would be analogous is if the gentleman from Pumadela had argued for banning of driving altogether. Because that is what the DTR's policy by analogy is suggesting. The speed limit is an entirely valid regulation subject to license condition within the confines of a legal, constitutional, democracy and legislative framework. So I just wanted to make the point about analogies. There's been lots of them. On the two presentations, thank you very much, Mr. Lurie and Mr. Weissman, for presentation. I wanted to ask a question specifically for a little bit more detail on PigSpeak, because there has been some confusion, and I've tried to understand myself, but it's bewildering in terms of its legal complexity. So I don't want you to take us through the A to Z of the case, because that will take us as long as it has to the top. But if you could just give us some brief background into exactly what happened there and what implications were for online. The second question is, you made a fascinating point up front about the 2004 Act and the requirements of the Minister. It's something that I made reference to in my presentation to the committee last week, that in fact the 2004 Act requires the Minister to come to Parliament within 2 years with a bill to regulate online gambling. But he's obviously not done that despite his efforts in 2008. There is no Act enforced to regulate online gambling. What exactly are you suggesting in that regard? Is it actually the case are you suggesting that the Minister is in contravention of the 2004 Act? And what does that mean for the policy document that the DTI has presented? Because the policy document that the DTI has presented is obviously contrary to that Act in terms of its policy approach. So I'd like to ask about that.
Thank you, Honourable
Hill-Lewis,
Honourable Elvis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the good presentations by both lawyers. I think my question is basically at both of you, Mr. Lurie and Mr. Weissman. What is interesting, what you brought up, that has not been, that I haven't seen before, is the international law context. And I was actually going to ask my colleague next door if he wanted to appear at any investigation regarding our World Trade Organization obligations and how that dovetails with what's happening out there in the world, and what implication of that will be if we do not regulate or if we do regulate. That's very important to take into account, considering the nature of the internet beast being a global animal, and that's very difficult to police in any of that. Thank you very much.
Honourable Colonel?
Thank you. Can I just also thank, I think it's a very good two presentations and lots of food for thought, but why do the legal industry interested in this? Now, can it bring more work? Do you want regulation for that? You know, what is your interest? You know, that is quite interesting. Very good presentation, and I hear many things to say. but I want to know what is the legal industry's interest in such a law.
Interesting that of the three, there are two advocates there, and not two on this side. Now, I'm not an advocate, neither is Honourable Hill Lippitt. But now I'm just puzzled. I know that lawyers are English excellent, so just worried about this. I think this is by yourself, Advocate Lurie. You refer to rudimentary enforcement, etc., against players, and you use the point here, allowing the offenders to display themselves with impunity by punishing the purchaser. If one allows something, it means, as a government, it's okay. Do we mean that it happens, but we don't allow it, but it is happening? If something happens, it may not necessarily mean that you've given permission for it to happen. So I'm just wondering the use of that word benign. And then the point made somewhere else about possibly it may be yourself then, Mr. Weitzman, did you refer to the United States, Singapore and elsewhere?
Right.
You know, I noticed that you're very clearly able to classify Singapore and China, you know, the nine dictatorships, and the other one, I suppose, the great dictatorship. Okay. The champion, apparently, for democracy, you didn't want to say benign dictatorship or military dictatorship or whatever dictatorship. So you said it was conservative. Conservative but not permissive. You could argue that we're not permissive. I don't know. How would you classify South Africa? Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll start with your question to me about the use of the word allow. I feel quite strongly on this point because I believe that through a policy of complete remiss prohibition, we have allowed it. In that sense, and let me make clear, I am, of course, partisan to the industry. This is the area I practice in. Whether it's internet gambling operators or otherwise, I'm still going to practice in gambling law as well, my colleague. This, to some degree, answers the Honourable Cora's question. In fact, most of my work, because it's, my work has to, by nature, be legitimate, comes from the sport industry, which is, as we saw from BTR's reporting, the betting industry is the fastest growing gambling industry in South Africa. Of course, I'd like to see my natural sense of justice as a lawyer encourages me to see fair application of the law. And I believe that the law is not fairly applied, most importantly to the punter. It's the punter, like the one that my colleague and I see, who comes to us with the penalty notices from the Reserve Bank saying, these are the fines and penalties we're hitting you with because you gambled online. They don't even know that they were deemed illegal in the first place. I feel like it's kicking out at a hinty statement that these wares are displayed with impunity. People can go and use them on the internet, and then they are punished for doing that. If I might just quickly come to the Honourable Hill Lewis's questions. To summarise, actually, the litigation in the space of 2 or 3 minutes is going to be challenging, but in essence, what happened was PFP Casino, which was a licensed Swazi casino with the license to operate on the internet, was displaying billboards on the highway, the main highway to Johannesburg, M1, I believe, and they were on the radio with advertisements. And the Gauteng Gambling Board approached them and said, then what you're doing is legal. And they said, we cannot. We say we licensed in Swaziland. The gambling takes place in Swaziland in the same way that if you phone a friend at a table in Las Vegas and say, put $50 on red, as a gambling takes place at the table. In fact, that was an argument used in the court. They said, well, what are you going to do about this? We say it's illegal. You say it's not. They said, let's go to the High Court for declaratory. And it took so long because there was some fancy footwork during the declaratory process that we had to convert the summons, the application, the notice of motion to summons. And at that point, very cleverly, the Housing Board came in and said, but you can't have a summons because the underlying aspect is illegal. So there was a trial within a trial regarding that. Eventually it was found that the gambling to that Section 11 was contravened, that went to the SCA, and with absolute clarity the SCA made a point finding that, and it's ruling that, whether the gambling takes place, a portion of the gambling takes place in South Africa or elsewhere, it's contravening Section 11 and at the end of that, and therefore it's illegal in terms of Section 11, which is where we stand, as I said, all throughout. Which leads very nicely into the next question from the Honourable Hill Lewis, which is that whether I believe, and this is also personal opinion, whether I believe that DTI are in contravention of the Act. It is my belief that DTI are in contravention of the Act, or that the Ministry is in contravention of the Act, because the Act...
Sorry, Advocate Lewis, you should just repeat that. I only got the tail end.
Yeah, sure. What I was coming to was the question from the Honourable Lewis as to whether I believe DTR or the Minister are in contravention of their imperatives of the Act 7 2004, the National Gambling Act. And it's my personal opinion that they are in contravention because the Act has two provisions pertaining to remote gambling or interactive gambling. The first was a prohibition under Section 11, but the second was under transitional provisions, I believe it was Section 7 of the transitional provisions off the top of my head, Section 5, I'm correct, with my colleague, they said that within 2 years, the Minister will bring the draft legislation to this to the House, and it will prescribe regulation of gambling. Now, to some extent, it may be argued there was compliance with the 2008 amendments, although it was strictly outside of the timelines, but nothing further has been done. Now, whether we get into arguments about the intention of the legislature, or it's clearly appears from it, it's my strong view that the legislature will prescribe that this area must be regulated. Then we get into another further split here. Does regulation encompass prohibition? It might be argued, so I personally think not. But if there were the argument, then why, of course, was the prohibition not the prohibition in the first instance, as the form of regulation per se? So I hope that answers the question posed by Honourable Hill Lewis. I think my colleague wants to see the other questions.
Now, Chair, you're probably asking the most difficult question of all. How do I classify South Africa? Well, we know we're not Singapore. We know we're not China. We know we're not the US. This is just my personal view. If anything, as far as the way that the machinations of government work, our system of government, our system of courts, the activities which people indulge in, my honest view is that we're probably the most similar to the United Kingdom. You know, that's quite a good model to look at if we decide that we should be going a particular way, or because it has its peculiarities. Again, it's my personal view. I mean, I haven't been to China. I've spent time in the United States, and I've had many, many matters over the years in the United States. I in fact work for a Wall Street firm in London. One of the big New York firms. American law works somewhat differently, and you know our places. You know, we can't even compare ourselves to France, for example. It's a completely different setup. We have to look within as to how we work, how we operate, what is acceptable in my view as our society. The UK is probably the most closest comparison. The Honourable Colonel, as far as you know, you ask about what interest the legal industry have. Well, you know, there's money to be made here. What is my interest? I'm an attorney in the industry. I have to say though, and I'll be frank when I say I'm not here today giving these submissions on as a specific brief for any one particular time. This has been going on for 10 years, much to many people's consternation, including mine. I've had to unfortunately stand up at conferences overseas where they say, I'm on a panel and they say, what's new in Africa? I say nothing. And they say, well, when's something going to happen? I don't know. Enough is getting enough. We have to take a position on this. And that's why I'm here. I'm here as Aaron Weitzman with lots of experience in this industry to try and assist in the process. I'm honest to the industry. But this is not, you know, because of what I do. But this is not the driver for today. As far as the Honourable Mr. Elvis, Advocate Elvis has asked, well, I'm not sure that anyone's given appropriate, you know, I'm not sure that I want to give the answer because it's something that one of my clients may need to use at some stage or not, but it's something that I felt was necessary to alert this House to and alert the parliamentary advisors to, perhaps state law experts. It's something that seriously needs to be looked at because, you know, if Professor Kenny was raising this 7 years ago, this is nothing new. And since then, we've had the World Trade Organization Act with Antigua and the USA. The US got an absolute backhand from the World Trade Organization. It matters not to them. And at the end of the day, I think our experience is whatever the trade undertakings are, whatever the global requirements are, the US kind of does what it wants in any event, quite frankly. We're not the U.S. We don't conduct ourselves in that way. And that's what I'm saying. We don't just go running around arresting people in this country the way that Peter Dix, who was the chairman of Sporting Bet, got arrested in New York on a Louisiana warrant, or David Carrabas got arrested on a Missouri warrant and spent 5 years before anything happened. We don't have grand juries which go and invite people prior to things. We don't, we're not party to rendition, we're not party to extraordinary arrests. We do things in a very different way. And that's where I say we separate ourselves from the U.S. Again, you have to look at those cases in isolation. I'll tell you, Ross, there's a very funny story, how strange it is. Wayne and I, Mr. Louis and I, went to, were you in New Orleans? Sorry, okay. There was one of the, both Mr. Louis and I, members of the International Masters Gaming Organization, which is a by-invitation organization of like, I think the leading lawyers in the world on gambling or from around the world. And we had a conference in New Orleans, which was fairly soon after Mr. Dix had been arrested, who was the chairman of Sporting Bet PLC, a company listed on the London Stock Exchange, but let go by Governor Patakis in New York State because he was arrested on a Louisiana warrant. And we were at a conference in New Orleans, and the organizers got special dispensation from the investigating officers there to ensure that none of the attorneys that were involved in with gaming, online gambling clients internationally would be arrested when we got to New Orleans. I mean, this is how crazy things get there, and this is how crazy things got there. So it's very, very different. But seriously, honorable member, it's something which real consideration needs to be given to.
I'm on the same post advocate, and you know, you have added to our knowledge, I must say. I thank you for your time and contribution here. As you probably are aware of, the department has tabled a policy, policy document, and that was on the 8th of May, I think it was gazetted. Is that right, DDG, on the 8th of May? And clearly, I think the time it gave means, 22nd, 23rd of June, that the stakeholders would have to start with their inputs. So you may well think of making submission on the policy and having a look at that as well. That would be quite useful for you, Chad. Now look, honourable members, we want to end this year. We're a little bit over time, but I think that there has been serious input here, serious engagement. We want to thank all of you, including those who have just left, for your submissions and for taking this seriously as well. Thank you very much. So just to mention to the committee, there are one or two things I'll ask of them, if we could just put the program on the table and just to refer to this. On the 5th of June, we're going to be having the engagement with the NLB and distributing agencies on the current status of its distributing activities in their respective sectors. Some of you may be aware that I've had a fair amount of correspondence from members of the public who are concerned about certain things there with the distribution agency, and they do fall under us, the NLB, etc. So that would be constructive for us as DTI to see them. We've also agreed with the Portfolio Committee on Arts and Culture, who have invited the Arts and Culture National Heritage Sector to engage with them, that we would be there for a while. Of course, I know members often say, is it compulsory? Let me put it this way, you may find it constructive to be there, and I would certainly commend that to as many of you as possible. It is one of our Tuesday meeting days, but we will meet ourselves separately at 10:30 for a briefing by the DTI on the Board-Based Black Economic Empowerment Codes of Good Practice. If you remember, we asked the minister, we want to get clarification. That will be in M46 at 10:30 on Tuesday. The other point is that I'm sure the
members of the advocates who made the missions on my right may appreciate this better than ourselves. You know, the policy, we've been asking for policy since time immemorial. I came into the committee as chair in 2009. The first thing we hit my desk and other members was interactive gambling, as the thing called. And I see Advocate Van der Leeuwen nodding, and she's quite well aware of that. And we said then at the time, whoa, hang on, where's the policy around this, you see? We're not prepared to just go into this. Where's the study? And we were ourselves attempting to hold such a study when the department indicated it would commission a study on gambling, which in fact you had, the National Gambling Commission at that point. Now, we recently had, and over the last few years, the minister has been telling the committee that policy is being developed. Policy has been drafted, it is gazetted, it's there. And I would really like the committee to engage on a policy first, complete that process, and then pick up the bill again, the remote gambling bill. I had a brief informal meeting with Honourable Hill Lewis, and I managed to persuade him that we do need to do the policy first. We were not aware we hit our desk now. So that is where we are going. I shall certainly inform the Minister of the situation in this regard, but I have also made it clear we will keep the remote gambling bill open after the 17th of June, CETA, when CETA come here, and we will continue to entertain any submissions made on it. They will be retained here. So I want to make that clear. And I also want to request that we consider yourself, Honourable Mkongi, to just hold the reins there. We don't want to establish a subcommittee. And I've since learned that I can't even establish a task team without it becoming subcommittee in terms of Parliament's rules. But they haven't managed to rein in the principle or concept of saying a member of the committee will just keep track of these submissions coming in, and of course the proponent of the actual legislation, Honourable Hill Lewis, will certainly be given this all along and made aware of it. So that is where we understand on this, but I do want to persuade all those having made submissions to follow this. What do they say, follow this line or whatever, you know, but their issues will be there all the time. But the policy, I think it will be very constructive for members who want to have an influence on this to make submissions on policy to the department, not to us. This is still with the department, actually, DEI. Thank you very much. On that note, members, we want to wish you well, Honourable Hill Lewis. I believe you're going to Russia, are you? Are you?
That's the obvious.
I hope you picked up a little conversation book and bring back a few hats and whatever. Right. God see. We'll see the rest of you on Tuesday. Okay, Friday. I am fully corrected. Friday.